This is Audible.
Brought to you by Penguin.
Invisible Women by Caroline Criado Perez. Read by Caroline Criado Perez. For the women who persist, keep on being bloody difficult. Representation of the world, like the world itself, is the work of men. They describe it from their own point of view, which they confuse with the absolute truth. Simone de Beauvoir. Preface. Most of recorded human history is one big data gap. Starting with the theory of man the hunter, the chroniclers of the past have left little space for women's role in the evolution of humanity, whether cultural or biological. Instead, the lives of men have been taken to represent those of humans overall. When it comes to the lives of the other half of humanity, there is often nothing but silence. And these silences are everywhere. Our entire culture is riddled with them. Films, news, literature, science, city planning, economics. The stories we tell ourselves about our past, present, and future, they are all marked, disfigured, by a female-shaped, absent presence. This is the gender data gap. The gender data gap isn't just about silence. These silences, these gaps, have consequences. They impact on women's lives every day. The impact can be relatively minor, shivering in offices set to a male temperature norm, for example, or struggling to reach a top shelf set at a male height norm. Irritating, certainly. Unjust, undoubtedly. But not life-threatening. Not like crashing in a car whose safety measures don't account for women's measurements. Not like having your heart attack go undiagnosed because your symptoms are deemed atypical. For these women, the consequences of living in a world built around male data can be deadly. One of the most important things to say about the gender data gap is that it is not generally malicious or even deliberate. Quite the opposite. It is simply the product of a way of thinking that has been around for millennia and is therefore a kind of not thinking, a double not thinking even. Men go without saying and women don't get said at all. Because when we say human, on the whole, we mean man. This is not a new observation. Simone de Beauvoir made it most famously when in 1949 she wrote, "Humanity is male, and man defines woman not in herself, but as relative to him. She is not regarded as an autonomous being. He is the subject, he is the absolute, she is the other." What is new is the context in which women continue to be the other, and that context is a world increasingly reliant on and enthralled to data, big data, which in turn is panned for big truths by big algorithms using big computers. But when your big data is corrupted by big silences, the truths you get are half-truths at best, and often, for women, they aren't true at all. As computer scientists themselves say, garbage in, garbage out. This new context makes the need to close the gender data gap ever more urgent. Artificial intelligence that helps doctors with diagnoses, that scans through CVs, even that conducts interviews with potential job applicants is already common. But AIs have been trained on datasets that are riddled with data gaps. And because algorithms are often protected as proprietary software, we can't even examine whether these gaps have been taken into account. On the available evidence, however, it certainly doesn't look as if they have. Numbers, technology, algorithms, all of these are crucial to the story of invisible women. But they only tell half the story. Data is just another word for information, and information has many sources. Statistics are a kind of information, yes, but so is human experience. And so I will argue that when we are designing a world that is meant to work for everyone, we need women in the room. If the people taking decisions that affect all of us are all white, able-bodied men, 9 times out of 10 from America, that too constitutes a data gap, in the same way that not collecting information on female bodies in medical research is a data gap. And as I will show, failing to include the perspective of women is a huge driver of an unintended male bias that attempts, often in good faith, to pass itself off as gender neutral. This is what de Beauvoir meant when she said that men confuse their own point of view with the absolute truth. The female-specific concerns that men fail to factor in cover a wide variety of areas. But as you listen, you will notice that 3 themes crop up again and again. The female body, women's unpaid care burden, and male violence against women. These are issues of such significance that they touch on nearly every part of our lives, affecting our experiences of everything from public transport to politics, via the workplace and the doctor's surgery. But men forget them, because men do not have female bodies. They, as we will see, do only a fraction of the unpaid work done by women. And while they do have to contend with male violence, it manifests in a different way to the violence faced by women. And so these differences go ignored, and we proceed as if the male body and its attendant life experience are gender neutral. This is a form of discrimination against women. Throughout this book, I will refer to both sex and gender. By sex, I mean the biological characteristics that determine whether an individual is male or female, XX and XY. By gender, I mean the social meanings we impose upon those biological facts, the way women are treated because they are perceived to be female. One is man-made, but both are real, and both have significant consequences for women as they navigate this world constructed on male data. But although I talk about both sex and gender throughout, I use gender data gap as an overarching term, because sex is not the reason women are excluded from data. Gender is. In naming the phenomenon that is causing so much damage to so many women's lives, I want to be clear about the root cause, and, contrary to many claims you'll read in these pages, the female body is not the problem. The problem is a social meaning that we ascribe to that body, and a socially determined failure to account for it. Invisible Women is a story about absence, and that sometimes makes it hard to write about. If there is a data gap for women overall, both because we don't collect the data in the first place and because when we do, we usually don't separate it by sex, when it comes to women of colour, disabled women, working class women, the data is practically non-existent. Not simply because it isn't collected, but because it is not separated out from the male data, what is called sex disaggregated data. In statistics on representation from academic jobs to film roles, data is given for women and ethnic minorities, with data for female ethnic minorities lost within each larger group. Where they exist, I have given them, but they barely ever do. The point of this book is not psychoanalysis. I do not have direct access to the innermost thoughts of those who perpetuate the gender data gap, which means this book cannot provide ultimate proof for why the gender data gap exists. I can only present you with the data and ask you, as a listener, to look at the evidence. But nor am I interested in whether or not the person who produced a male bias tool was a secret sexist. Private motivations are, to a certain extent, irrelevant. What matters is the pattern. What matters is whether, given the weight of the data I will present, it is reasonable to conclude that the gender data gap is all just one big coincidence. I will argue that it is not. I will argue that the gender data gap is both a cause and a consequence of the type of unthinking that conceives of humanity as almost exclusively male. I will show how often and how widely this bias crops up, and how it distorts the supposedly objective data that increasingly rules our lives. I will show that even in this super-rational world, increasingly run by super-impartial supercomputers, women are still very much de Beauvoir's second sex, and that the dangers of being relegated to, at best, a subtype of men, are as real as they have ever been. Introduction. The default male. Seeing men as the human default is fundamental to the structure of human society. It's an old habit, and it runs deep, as deep as theories of human evolution itself. In the 4th century BC, Aristotle was already baldly articulating male default as unarguable fact. The first departure from type is indeed that the offspring should become female instead of male, he wrote in his biological treatise on the generation of animals. He did allow that this aberration was, however, a natural necessity. Over 2,000 years later, in 1966, the University of Chicago held a symposium on primitive hunter-gatherer societies. It was called Man the Hunter. Over 75 social anthropologists from around the world gathered to debate the centrality of hunting to human evolution and development. The consensus was that it's pretty central. The biology, psychology, and customs that separate us from the apes, all these we owe to the hunters of time past, claimed one of the papers published in the resulting book. Which is all very well, only, as feminists pointed out, this theory poses something of a problem for female evolution, because, as the book made clear, hunting was a male activity. So if our intellect, interests, emotions, and basic social life all are evolutionary products of the success of hunting adaptation, what does that mean for women's humanity? If human evolution is driven by men, are women even human? In her now classic 1975 essay, Woman the Gatherer, anthropologist Sally Slocum challenged the primacy of Man the Hunter. Anthropologists, she argued, Search for examples of the behaviour of males and assume that this is sufficient for explanation. And so she asked a simple question to fill the silence. What were the females doing while the males were out hunting? Answer: gathering, weaning, caring for children during longer periods of infant dependency, all of which would similarly have required cooperation. In the context of this knowledge, the conclusion that the basic human adaptation was the desire of males to hunt and kill, objects Slocum, gives too much importance to aggression, which is, after all, only one factor of human life. Slocum made her critique over 40 years ago now, but the male bias in evolutionary theory persists. Humans evolved to have an instinct for deadly violence, researchers find, read a 2016 headline in The Independent. The article reported on an academic paper called The Phylogenetic Roots of Human Lethal Violence, which claimed to reveal that humans have evolved to be 6 times more deadly to their own species than the average mammal. This is no doubt true of our species overall, but the reality of human-on-human lethal violence is that it is overwhelmingly a male occupation. A 30-year analysis of murder in Sweden found that 9 out of 10 murders are committed by men. This holds with statistics from other countries, including Australia, the UK, and the US. A 2013 UN homicide survey found that 96% of homicide perpetrators worldwide are male. So is it humans who are murderous, or men? And if women aren't on the whole murdering, what are we to think of female phylogenetics? The male, unless otherwise indicated, approach to research seems to have infected all sorts of ethnographic fields. Cave paintings, for example, are often of game animals, and so researchers have assumed they were done by men, the hunters. But new analysis of handprints that appear alongside such paintings in cave sites in France and Spain has suggested that the majority were actually done by women. Even human bones are not exempt from male unless otherwise indicated thinking. We might think of human skeletons as being objectively either male or female, and therefore exempt from male default thinking. We would be wrong. For over 100 years, a 10th century Viking skeleton known as the Birka warrior had, despite possessing an apparently female pelvis, been assumed to be male because it was buried alongside a full set of weapons and 2 sacrificed horses. These grave contents indicated that the occupant had been a warrior, and warrior meant male. Archaeologists put the numerous references to female fighters in Viking lore down to mythical embellishments. But although weapons apparently trump the pelvis when it comes to sex, they don't trump DNA, and in 2017, testing confirmed that these bones did indeed belong to a woman. The argument didn't, however, end there. It just shifted. The bones might have been mixed up. There might be other reasons a female body was buried with these items. Naysaying scholars might have a point on both counts, although based on the layout of the grave contents, the original authors dismiss these criticisms. But the resistance is nevertheless revealing, particularly since male skeletons in similar circumstances are not questioned in the same way. Indeed, when archaeologists dig up grave sites, they nearly always find more males, which, as noted anthropologist Philip Walker dryly noted in a 1995 book chapter on sexing skulls, is not consistent with what we know about the sex ratios of extant human populations. And given Viking women could own property, could inherit, and could become powerful merchants, is it so impossible that they could have fought too? After all, these are far from the only female warrior bones that have been discovered. Battle-scarred skeletons of multiple women have been found across the Eurasian steppes from Bulgaria to Mongolia, wrote Natalie Haynes in The Guardian. For people such as the ancient Scythians, who fought on horseback with bows and arrows, there was no innate male warrior advantage, and DNA testing of skeletons buried with weapons in more than 1,000 Scythian burial mounds from Ukraine to Central Asia have revealed that up to 37% of Scythian women and girls were active warriors. The extent to which male, unless otherwise indicated, permeates our thinking may seem less surprising when you realise that it is also embedded in one of the most basic building blocks of society, language itself. Indeed, when Slocum criticised male bias in anthropology, she pointed out that this bias appeared not only in the ways in which the scanty data are interpreted, but in the very language used. The word man, she wrote, is used in such an ambiguous fashion that it is impossible to decide whether it refers to males or to the human species in general. This collapse in meaning led Slocum to suspect that, in the minds of many anthropologists, man, supposedly meaning the human species, is actually exactly synonymous with males. As we shall see, the evidence suggests that she was probably right. In Muriel Rukeyser's poem, Myth, an old blind Oedipus asks the Sphinx, "Why didn't I recognise my mother?" The Sphinx replies that Oedipus answered her question, what walks on four legs in the morning, two in the afternoon, and three in the evening, incorrectly. You answered man. You didn't say anything about woman. But, replies Oedipus, when you say man, you include women too. Everyone knows that. But in fact, the Sphinx was right and Oedipus is wrong. When you say man, you don't include women too, even if everyone does technically know that. Numerous studies in a variety of languages over the past 40 years have consistently found that what is called the generic masculine, using words like he in a gender-neutral way, is in fact not read generically. It is read overwhelmingly as male. When the generic masculine is used, people are more likely to recall famous men than famous women, to estimate a profession as male-dominated, to suggest male candidates for jobs and political appointments. Women are also less likely to apply and less likely to perform well in interviews for jobs that are advertised using the generic masculine. In fact, the generic masculine is read so overwhelmingly as male that it even overrides otherwise powerful stereotypes, so that professions such as beautician, which are usually stereotyped female, are suddenly seen as male. It even distorts scientific studies, creating a kind of meta-gender data gap. A 2015 paper looking at self-report bias in psychological studies found that the use of the generic masculine in questionnaires affected women's responses, potentially distorting the meaning of test scores. The authors concluded that its use may portray unreal differences between women and men, which would not appear in the gender-neutral form or in natural gender language versions of the same questionnaire. And yet, in the face of decades of evidence that the generic masculine is anything but clear, official language policy in many countries continues to insist that it is purely a formality whose use must continue for the sake of clarity. As recently as 2017, the Académie Française, France's ultimate authority on the French language, was thundering against the aberration of inclusive writing, claiming that the French language finds itself in mortal danger from workarounds for the generic masculine. Other countries, including Spain and Israel, have faced similar rows. Because English is not a grammatically gendered language, the generic masculine is fairly restricted in modern usage. Terms like doctor and poet used to be generic masculine, with specifically female doctors and poets referred to, usually derisively, as poetesses and doctoresses, but are now considered gender neutral. But while the formal use of the generic masculine only really clings on in the writings of pedants who still insist on using he to mean he or she, it has made something of a comeback in the informal usage of Americanisms such as dude and guys, and in the UK, lads, as supposedly gender-neutral terms. A recent row in the UK also showed that, for some, male default still matters an awful lot. When in 2017, the first female head of London's fire brigade, Danny Cotton, suggested that we should replace fireman with the now standard, and let's face it, much cooler, firefighter, she received a deluge of hate mail. Languages such as French, German, and Spanish, however, are what is called gender-inflected, and here the concept of masculine and feminine is woven into the language itself. All nouns are gendered either masculine or feminine. A table is feminine, but a car is masculine. La mesa roja, the red table, el coche rojo, the red car. When it comes to nouns that refer to people, while both male and female terms exist, the standard gender is always masculine. Try searching Google for lawyer in German. It comes back Anwalt, which literally means male lawyer, but is also used generically as just lawyer. If you wanted to refer to a female lawyer specifically, you would say Anwältin. Incidentally, the way female terms are often, as here, modified male terms, is another subtle way we position the female as a deviation from male type, as in de Beauvoir's terms, other. The generic masculine is also used when referring to groups of people. When the gender is unknown, or if it's a mixed group, the generic masculine is used. So a group of 100 female teachers in Spanish would be referred to as las profesoras. But as soon as you add a single male teacher, the group suddenly becomes los profesores. Such is the power of the default male. In gender-inflected languages, the generic masculine remains pervasive. Job vacancies are still often announced with masculine forms, particularly if they are for leadership roles. A recent Austrian study of the language used in leadership jobs ads found a 27-to-1 ratio of masculine to gender-fair forms, using both the male and female term. The European Parliament believes it has found a solution to this problem, and since 2008 has recommended that brackets MF be added on the end of job ads in gender-inflected languages. The idea is that this makes the generic masculine more fair by reminding us that women exist. It's a nice idea, but it wasn't backed up by data. When researchers did test its impact, they found that it made no difference to the exclusionary impact of using the generic masculine on its own, illustrating the importance of collecting data and then creating policy. Does all this arguing over words make any real-world difference? Arguably, yes. In 2012, a World Economic Forum analysis found that countries with gender-inflected languages, which have strong ideas of masculine and feminine present in almost every utterance, are the most unequal in terms of gender. But here's an interesting quirk. Countries with genderless languages, such as Hungarian and Finnish, are not the most equal. Instead, that honour belongs to a third group, countries with natural gender languages, such as English. These languages allow gender to be marked, female teacher, male nurse, but largely don't encode it into the words themselves. The study authors suggested that if you can't mark gender in any way, you can't correct the hidden bias in a language by emphasising women's presence in the world. In short, because men go without saying, it matters when women literally can't get said at all. It's tempting to think that the male bias that is embedded in language is simply a relic of more regressive times, but the evidence does not point that way. The world's fastest growing language, used by more than 90% of the world's online population, is emoji. This language originated in Japan in the 1980s, and women are its heaviest users. 78% of women versus 60% of men frequently use emoji. And yet, until 2016, the world of emojis was curiously male. The emojis we have on our smartphones are chosen by the rather grand-sounding Unicode Consortium, a Silicon Valley-based group of organisations that work together to ensure universal international software standards. If Unicode decides a particular emoji, say spy, should be added to the current stable, they will decide on the code that should be used. Each phone manufacturer, or platform such as Twitter and Facebook, will then design their own interpretation of what a spy looks like. But they will all use the same code, so that when users communicate between different platforms, they are broadly all saying the same thing. An emoji face with heart eyes is an emoji face with heart eyes. Unicode has not historically specified the gender for most emoji characters. The emoji that most platforms originally represented as a man running was not called man running. It was just called runner. Similarly, the original emoji for police officer was described by Unicode as police officer, not policeman. It was the individual platforms that all interpreted these gender-neutral terms as male. In 2016, Unicode decided to do something about this. Abandoning their previously neutral gender stance, they decided to explicitly gender all emojis that depicted people. So instead of runner, which had been universally represented as male runner, Unicode issued code for explicitly male runner and explicitly female runner. Male and female options now exist for all professions and athletes. It's a small victory, but a significant one. It's easy to slam phone manufacturers and social media platforms as sexist, and as we shall see, they are, if often unknowingly. But the reality is that even if they had somehow managed to design an image of a gender-neutral runner, most of us would still have read that runner as male, because we read most things as male unless they are specifically marked as female. And so while it is, of course, to be hoped that angry grammarians will come round to the idea that saying he and she, or even, God forbid, she and he, instead of just he, may not be the worst thing that has ever happened to them, the truth is that getting rid of the generic masculine would only be half the battle. Male bias is so firmly embedded in our psyche that even genuinely gender-neutral words are read as male. A 2015 study identified the top five words used to refer to people in human-computer interaction papers published in 2014 and found that they are all apparently gender-neutral. User, participant, person, designer, and researcher. Well done, human-computer interaction academics. But there is, of course, a catch. When study participants were instructed to think about one of these words for 10 seconds and then draw an image of it, it turned out that these apparently gender-neutral words were not perceived as equally likely to be male or female. For male participants, only designer was interpreted as male less than 80% of the time. It was still almost 70% male. A researcher was more likely to be depicted as of no gender than as a female. Women were slightly less gender biased, but on the whole were still more likely to read gender-neutral words as male, with only person and participant, both read by about 80% of male participants as male, being about 50-50. This rather disheartening finding tallies with decades of drawer scientist data, where participants overwhelmingly draw men. The bias has historically been so extreme that media around the world celebrated as great progress a recent paper which found that 28% of children now draw women. It also tallies, perhaps more disturbingly, with a 2008 study in which Pakistani students, aged 9 and 10, were asked to draw an image of us. Hardly any of the female students drew women, and none of the male students did. We don't even allow non-humans to escape our perception of the world as overwhelmingly male. When researchers in one study attempted to prompt participants to see a gender-neutral stuffed animal as female by using female pronouns, children, parents, and carers still overwhelmingly referred to the animal as he. The study found that an animal must be super feminine before even close to half of participants will refer to it as she rather than he. To be fair, it's not an entirely unreasonable assumption. Often it really is a he. A 2007 international study of 25,439 children's TV characters found that only 13% of non-human characters are female. The figure for female human characters was slightly better, although still low at 32%. An analysis of G-rated, suitable for children, films, released between 1990 and 2005 found that only 28% of speaking roles went to female characters. And perhaps even more tellingly, in the context of humans being male by default, women made up only 17% of crowd scenes. Men don't just have more roles. They also spend twice as much time on screen. This rises to nearly three times as much when, as most films do, the film has a male lead. Only when the lead is female do men and women appear about as often as each other, as opposed to women getting, as you might expect, the majority of screen time. Men also get more lines, speaking twice as much as women overall, three times as much in films with male leads, and almost twice as much in films with male and female co-leads. Again, it is only in the few films with female leads where male and female characters drew even on screen time. This imbalance is found not just in films and TV. It's everywhere. It's in statues. When I counted all the statues in the UK's Public Monuments and Sculptures Association database, I found that there were more statues of men called John than there were of historical named non-royal women. The only reason adding royal women to the figures just beats the Johns is down to Queen Victoria, whose enthusiasm for putting up statues of herself I have a grudging respect for. It's on banknotes. In 2013, the Bank of England announced they were replacing the only female historical figure on their banknotes with another man. I fought a successful campaign against it, and campaigns have cropped up in other countries, including Canada and the US. It's in the news media. Every 5 years since 1995, the Global Media Monitoring Project has evaluated the world's print and broadcast media for its representation of women. Its latest report, published in 2015, found that women make up only 24% of the persons heard, read about, or seen in newspaper, television, and radio news, exactly as they did in 2010. It's even in school textbooks. 30 years of language and grammar textbook studies in countries including Germany, the US, Australia, and Spain have found that men far outnumber women in example sentences, on average by about 3 to 1. A US study of 18 widely used high school history textbooks, published between 1960 and 1990, found that pictures of named men outnumbered pictures of named women by a ratio of about 18 to 100, and that only 9% of the names in the indexes were women, a figure that persisted into the 2002 edition of one of the textbooks. More recently, a 2017 analysis of 10 introductory political science textbooks found that an average of only 10.8% of pages per text referenced women. Some texts were as low as 5.3%. The same level of male bias has been found in recent analyses of Armenian, Malawian, Pakistani, Taiwanese, South African, and Russian textbooks. So widespread is this cultural bias towards representing men that the makers of the classic sci-fi action game series Metroid relied on it when they wanted to surprise their users. We wondered what would surprise everyone and talked about removing main character Samus's helmet. Then someone said, "It would be a shocker if Samus turned out to be a woman," they recalled in a recent interview. And to make sure everyone really got it, they put her in a pink bikini and hip-jutting pose. Metroid was, and remains, something of an outlier in gaming. Although a 2015 Pew Research Center report found that equal numbers of American men and women play video games, only 3.3% of the games spotlighted at press conferences during 2016's E3, the world's largest annual gaming expo, starred female protagonists. This is actually lower than the figure for 2015, which, according to Feminist Frequency, was 9%. If female playable characters do make it into a game, they are still often framed as just another feature. At E3 2015, the director of Fallout 4, Todd Howard, revealed how easy it was to switch between male and female playable characters, only to switch back to the male version for the rest of the demo. As Feminist Frequency remarked when they released their data on E3 2016, heroes are male by default. The result of this deeply male-dominated culture is that the male experience, the male perspective, has come to be seen as universal, while the female experience, that of half the global population after all, is seen as, well, niche. It is because what is male is universal that when a professor at Georgetown University named her literature course White Male Writers, she hit the headlines, while the numerous courses on female writers pass unremarked. It is because what is male is universal and what is female is niche that a film about the fight of British women for their right to vote is slammed, in The Guardian no less, as peculiarly hermetic for not covering the First World War, sadly proving that Virginia Woolf's 1929 observation, "This is an important book," the critic assumes, because it deals with war. "This is an insignificant book," because it deals with the feelings of women in a drawing room, is still relevant today. It is why V.S. Naipaul criticises Jane Austen's writing as narrow, while at the same time no one is expecting The Wolf of Wall Street to address the Gulf War, or Norwegian writer Karl Ove Knausgård to write about anyone but himself, or quote more than a single female writer, to receive praise from The New Yorker for voicing universal anxieties in his 6-volume autobiography. It is why the England National Football Team page on Wikipedia is about the men's national football team, while the women's page is called the England Women's National Football Team, and why in 2013 Wikipedia divided writers into American novelists and American women novelists. It is why a 2015 study of multiple language Wikipedias found that articles about women include words like woman, female, or lady, but articles about men don't contain words like man, masculine, or gentleman, because the male sex goes without saying. We class the 14th to 17th centuries as the Renaissance, even though, as social psychologist Carol Tavris points out in her 1991 book The Myth's Measure of Woman, it wasn't a Renaissance for women, who were still largely excluded from intellectual and artistic life. We call the 18th century the Enlightenment, even though, while it may have expanded the rights of man, it narrowed the rights of women, who were denied control of their property and earnings and barred from higher education and professional training. We think of ancient Greece as the cradle of democracy, although the female half of the population were explicitly excluded from voting. In 2013, British tennis player Andy Murray was lauded across the media for ending Britain's 77-year wait to win Wimbledon, when in fact Virginia Wade had won it in 1977. 3 years later, Murray was informed by a sports reporter that he was the first person ever to win 2 Olympic tennis gold medals. Murray correctly replied that Venus and Serena have won about 4 each. In the US, it is a truth universally acknowledged that its soccer team has never won the World Cup or even reached the final, except it has. Its women's team has won 4 times. Recent years have seen some laudable attempts to address this relentless male cultural bias, but these are often met with hostility. When Thor was reinvented as a woman by Marvel Comics, fans revolted, although, as Wired magazine pointed out, no one uttered a peep when Thor was replaced by a frog. When the Star Wars franchise released 2 films in a row with a female lead, howls of outrage reverberated around the manosphere. One of the UK's longest-running television shows, Doctor Who, is a sci-fi fantasy series about a shape-shifting alien who periodically morphs into a new body, and the alien's first 12 incarnations were all male. But in 2017, for the first time, the Doctor morphed into a woman. In response, former Doctor Peter Davison expressed doubts about the wisdom of casting a woman in the role of Doctor Who. He preferred the idea of the Doctor as a boy and mourned the loss of a role model for boys. Upset men took to Twitter calling for a boycott of the show, condemning the decision as PC and liberal virtue signalling. Colin Baker, the boy into whom the Peter Davison Doctor had morphed, disagreed with his predecessor. "Boys have had 50 years of having a role model," he argued. "And in any case," he mused, "do you have to be the same gender as someone to be a role model? Can't you be a role model as people?" "Not really, Colin, because as we've seen, people tends to be read as male. And in any case, while there is evidence that women can, to a certain extent, accept men as role models, men won't do the same for women. Women will buy books by and about men, but men won't buy books by and about women, or at least not many. When adventure video game series Assassin's Creed announced in 2014 that it would not be possible to play as a female assassin in their new cooperative multiplayer mode, some male players were pleased with the decision. Playing as a woman would alienate them from the game, they argued. Journalist Sarah Dightem has little time for this argument. Come on now, she chided in a column. You've played games as a blue hedgehog, as a cybernetically augmented space marine, as a sodding dragon tamer. But the idea that women can be protagonists with an inner life and an active nature is somehow beyond your imaginative capacities? Dightem is, of course, technically right. It should be easier to imagine yourself as a woman than as a blue hedgehog. But on the other hand, she's also wrong, because that blue hedgehog has one particularly important similarity with male players, even more so than species alignment, and that is that Sonic the Hedgehog is male. We know this because he isn't pink, he doesn't have a bow in his hair, and he doesn't simper. He is the standard, unmarked gender, not the atypical one. This kind of negative reaction to the introduction of women is witnessed all over the cultural landscape. When in 2013, I campaigned to have a female historical figure on the back of English banknotes, some men got so angry that they felt compelled to threaten me with rape, mutilation, and death. Not all the men who disliked the campaign went that far, of course, but the sense of injustice was still clear in the more measured responses I got. I remember one man expostulating, "But women are everywhere now!" Clearly, given I was having to campaign so hard for the inclusion of one woman, they aren't. But his perspective was nevertheless telling. These men were experiencing even minor female representation as an iniquity. As far as they were concerned, the playing field was already level, and the entirely male lineup was just an objective reflection of merit. Before they caved, the Bank of England's case for their all-male lineup also rested on the meritocracy argument. Historical figures were, they said, chosen using an objective selection criteria. To join the gilded list of key figures from our past, a person must fulfil the following: have broad name recognition, have good artwork, not be controversial, and have made a lasting contribution which is universally recognised and has enduring benefits. Reading these subjective designations of worth, I realised how the bank had ended up with five white men on its banknotes. The historical gender data gap means that women are just far less likely to be able to fulfil any of these objective criteria. In 1839, the composer Clara Schumann wrote in her diary, "I once thought that I possessed creative talent, but I have given up this idea. A woman must not desire to compose. Not one has been able to do it, and why should I expect to?" The tragedy is, Schumann was wrong. Women before her had been able to do it, and they included some of the most successful, prolific, and influential composers of the 17th and 18th centuries. It's just that they didn't have broad name recognition, because a woman barely has to die before she is forgotten, or before we consign her work to the gender data gap by attributing it to a man. Felix Mendelssohn published six of his sister Fanny Hensel's pieces under his own name, and in 2010 another manuscript previously thought to be his was proven to be Hensel's. For years, classical scholars argued that the Roman poet Sulpicia couldn't possibly have written the verses signed with her name. They were too good, not to mention too smutty. Judith Leyster, one of the first Dutch women to be admitted to an artist's guild, was renowned in her time, but after her death in 1660, she was erased, her work attributed to her husband. In 2017, new works by 19th century artist Caroline Louisa Daly were discovered. They had been previously attributed to men, one of whom was not even an artist. At the turn of the 20th century, award-winning British engineer, physicist and inventor Hertha Ayrton remarked that while errors overall are notoriously hard to kill, an error that ascribes to a man what was actually the work of a woman has more lives than a cat. She was right. Textbooks still routinely name Thomas Hunt Morgan as the person who discovered that sex was determined by chromosomes rather than environment, despite the fact that it was Nettie Stevens' experiments on mealworms that established this, and despite the existence of correspondence between them, where Morgan writes to ask Stevens for details of her experiment. Cecilia Payne-Gaposchkin's discovery that the sun is predominantly composed of hydrogen is often credited to her male supervisor. Perhaps the most famous example of this kind of injustice is Rosalind Franklin, whose work, she had concluded via her X-ray experiments and unit cell measurements that DNA consisted of two chains and a phosphate backbone, led James Watson and Francis Crick, now Nobel Prize-winning household names, to discover DNA. None of this means that the Bank of England deliberately set out to exclude women. It just means that what may seem objective can actually be highly male-biased. In this case, the historically widespread practice of attributing women's work to men made it much harder for a woman to fulfill the bank's requirements. The fact is that worth is a matter of opinion. An opinion is informed by culture. And if that culture is as male-biased as ours is, it can't help but be biased against women. By default. The case of the bank's subjective selection criteria also shows how male default can be both a cause and a consequence of the gender data gap. By neglecting to account for the historical gender data gap, the bank's selection procedure for historical figures was designed around the kind of success typically achieved by men. Even a requirement as seemingly benign as that the figure not be controversial, well, as the historian Laurel Thatcher Ulrich famously put it, well-behaved women seldom make history. The result was that the bank not only failed to correct for the historical gender data gap, it perpetuated it. Such subjective designations of worth masquerading as objectivity crop up all over the place. In 2015, a British A-level student called Jessie McCabe noticed that of the 63 set works included in her music syllabus, not a single one was by a woman. When she wrote to her exam board, EdExcel, they defended the syllabus. Given that female composers were not prominent in the Western classical tradition, or others for that matter, they wrote, there would be very few female composers that could be included. The phrasing here is important. EdExcel doesn't mean that there simply aren't any female composers. After all, the International Encyclopedia of Women Composers alone has more than 6,000 entries. What they are talking about here is the canon. That is, the body of works generally agreed to have been the most influential in shaping Western culture. Canon formation is passed off as the objective trickle-down of the musical marketplace, but in truth, it is as subjective as any other value judgment made in an unequal society. Women have been locked out of the canon wholesale because what success looked like in composing has historically been almost impossible for women to achieve. For most of history, if women were allowed to compose at all, it was for a private audience and domestic setting. Large orchestral works, so crucial for the development of a composer's reputation, were usually off-limits, considered improper. Music was an ornament for women, not a career. Even by the 20th century, Elizabeth McConkie, who was the first woman ever to chair the Composers Guild of Great Britain, was being curtailed in her ambitions by publishers such as Leslie Boosie, who couldn't take anything except little songs from a woman. Even if the little songs women were allowed to write were enough to earn you a place in the canon, women simply didn't have the resources or position to ensure their legacy. In her book Sounds and Sweet Airs, The Forgotten Women of Classical Music, Anna Beer compares the prolific 17th century composer Barbara Strozzi, who had more music in print in her lifetime than any other composer of the era, to one of her male contemporaries, Francesco Cavalli. As head of music at St. Mark's in Venice, a position not open to women at the time, Cavalli had the money and the stature to ensure all his works, including the many he did not publish in his lifetime, were kept in a library. He could pay for an archivist to look after them, and he could, and did, pay for the masses he composed to be sung on the anniversary of his death. In the face of such inequality of resources, Strozzi never stood a chance of being remembered on an equal footing. And to continue to insist on the primacy of a canon that excludes women like her is to perpetuate the male-biased injustices of the past. As well as going some way to explaining their exclusion from cultural history, the exclusion of women from positions of power is often given as an excuse for why, when we teach them about the past, we teach children almost exclusively about the lives of men. In 2013, a battle raged in Britain over what we mean by history. On one side was the then British Secretary of State for Education, Michael Gove, brandishing his proposed new back-to-basics national history curriculum. An army of 21st century grad grinds, he and his supporters insisted that children needed facts. They needed a foundation of knowledge. This foundation of knowledge, the basic blocks of facts, which every child should know, was notable, amongst other gaps, for its almost wholesale absence of women. No women appeared in Key Stage 2, ages 7 to 11, at all, other than two Tudor queens. Key Stage 3, ages 11 to 14, included only five women, four of whom, Florence Nightingale, Mary Seacole, George Eliot and Annie Besant, were lumped together under the changing role of women, rather implying, not without reason, that the rest of the curriculum was about men. In 2009, prominent British historian David Starkey criticised female historians for, in his opinion, focusing too much on Henry VIII's wives rather than the king himself, who he railed, should be centre stage, dismissing the soap opera of his personal life as secondary to the formal political consequences of his rule, such as the Reformation. Starkey insisted that, if you are to do a proper history of Europe before the last 5 minutes, it is a history of white males, because they were the power players, and to pretend anything else is to falsify. Starkey's position rests on the assumption that what takes place in the private realm is unimportant. But is that a fact? The private life of Agnes Huntingdon, born after 1320, is revealed through snippets in public documents from the court cases concerning her two marriages. We discover that she was a victim of domestic abuse, and that her first marriage was disputed because her family disapproved of her choice. On the evening of the 25th of July, 1345, she ran away from her second husband after he attacked her. Later that night, he turned up at her brother's house with a knife. Is the abuse and lack of freedom of choice of a 14th century woman private irrelevancies, or part of the history of female subjugation? The arbitrary division of the world into private and public is in any case arguably a false distinction. Invariably, both bleed into each other. When I spoke to Catherine Edwards, a history teacher who was heavily involved in the fight against Gove's reforms, she pointed to recent research on women's role in the American Civil War. Far from being an irrelevance, women and their conception of their own role completely undermined the whole Confederate war effort. Elite women, brought up to believe absolutely in the myth of their own helplessness, simply could not get over their understanding of work as intrinsically unfeminine. Unable to bring themselves to take up the jobs vacated by enlisted men, they wrote to their husbands begging them to desert, to come home and protect them. Poorer women proved a headache in a more proactive way, as they organized resistance to Confederate policies, because they were starving, basically, and they needed to feed their families. Excluding women from an analysis of the outcome of the American Civil War not only constitutes a gender data gap, but also a data gap in the understanding of the construction of the United States itself. That seems like a fact worth knowing. The history of humanity, the history of art, literature and music, the history of evolution itself, all have been presented to us as objective facts. But the reality is, these facts have been lying to us. They have all been distorted by a failure to account for half of humanity, not least by the very words we use to convey our half-truths. This failure has led to gaps in the data, a corruption in what we think we know about ourselves. It has fueled the myth of male universality, and that is a fact. The persistence of this myth continues to affect how we see ourselves today, and if the past few years have shown us anything, it is that how we see ourselves is not a minor concern. Identity is a potent force that we ignore and misread at our peril. Trump, Brexit, and ISIS, to name just three recent examples, are global phenomena that have upended the world order, and they are all, at heart, identity-driven projects. But misreading and ignoring identity is exactly what obfuscating maleness under the guise of gender-neutral universality causes us to do. A man I briefly dated tried to win arguments with me by telling me I was blinded by ideology. I couldn't see the world objectively, he said, or rationally, because I was a feminist, and I saw everything through feminist eyes. When I pointed out that this was true for him too, he identified as a libertarian, he demurred. No, that was just objective common sense, de Beauvoir's absolute truth. For him, the way he saw the world was universal, while feminism, seeing the world from a female perspective, was niche. Ideological. I was reminded of this man in the wake of the 2016 US presidential election, when it felt you couldn't move for tweets, speeches, and op-eds by, usually, white men, decrying the ills of what they called identity politics. 10 days after Donald Trump's victory, the New York Times published an article by Mark Liller, professor of humanities at Columbia University, that criticized Clinton for calling out explicitly to African American, Latino, LGBT, and women voters. This left out, he said, the white working class. Liller presented Clinton's rhetoric of diversity as mutually exclusive with a large vision, linking this narrow vision, clearly Liller had been reading his V.S. Naipaul, with what he felt he was witnessing with college students. Students today, he claimed, were so primed to focus on diversity that they have shockingly little to say about such perennial questions as class, war, the economy, and the common good. 2 days after this was published, ex-Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders was in Boston at a stop on his book tour, explaining that it is not good enough for someone to say, I'm a woman, vote for me. In Australia, Paul Kelly, editor of The Australian, described Trump's victory as a revolt against identity politics, While over in the UK, Labour MP Richard Bergen tweeted that Trump's inauguration was what can happen when centre-left parties abandon transformation of economic system and rely on identity politics. The Guardian's Simon Jenkins concluded the Annus Horribilis that was 2016 with a diatribe against the identity apostles who had been over-defensive of minorities and thus killed off liberalism. "I have no tribe," he wrote. He could not join the prevailing hysteria. What he wanted was to reenact the glorious revolution of 1832, which resulted in the extension of the British franchise to a few extra 100,000 men of property. Heady days indeed. These white men have in common the following opinions. That identity politics is only identity politics when it's about race or sex. That race or sex have nothing to do with wider issues like the economy. That it is narrow to specifically address the concerns of female voters and voters of colour, and that working class means white working class men. Incidentally, according to the US Bureau of Labour Statistics, the coal mining industry, which during the 2016 election became the shibboleth for implicitly male working class jobs, provides 53,420 jobs in total, at a median annual wage of $59,380. Compare this to the majority female 924,640 strong cleaning and housekeeper workforce, whose median annual income is $21,820. So, who's the real working class? These white men also have in common that they are white men. And I labour this point because it is exactly their whiteness and maleness that caused them to seriously vocalise the logical absurdity that identities exist only for those who happen not to be white or male. When you have been so used, as a white man, to white and male going without saying, it's understandable that you might forget that white and male is an identity too. Pierre Bourdieu wrote in 1977 that what is essential goes without saying, because it comes without saying. The tradition is silent, not least about itself as a tradition. Whiteness and maleness are silent precisely because they do not need to be vocalised. Whiteness and maleness are implicit. They are unquestioned. They are the default. And this reality is inescapable for anyone whose identity does not go without saying, for anyone whose needs and perspective are routinely forgotten, for anyone who is used to jarring up against a world that has not been designed around them and their needs. The way whiteness and maleness goes without saying brings me back to my bad date. Okay, dates. Because it is intrinsically linked to the misguided belief in the objectivity, the rationality, the, as Catherine MacKinnon has it, point of viewlessness of the white male perspective. Because this perspective is not articulated as white and male, because it doesn't need to be, because it is the norm, it is presumed not to be subjective, it is presumed to be objective, universal even. This presumption is unsound. The truth is that white and male is just as much an identity as black and female. One study, which looked specifically at white Americans' attitudes and candidate preferences, found that Trump's success reflected the rise of white identity politics, which the researchers defined as an attempt to protect the collective interests of white voters via the ballot box. White identity, they concluded, strongly predicts a preference for Trump. And so did male identity. Analysis of how gender affected support for Trump revealed that the more hostile voters were toward women, the more likely they were to support Trump. In fact, hostile sexism was nearly as good at predicting support for Trump as party identification. And the only reason this is a surprise to us is because we are so used to the myth of male universality. The presumption that what is male is universal is a direct consequence of the gender data gap. Whiteness and maleness can only go without saying because most other identities never get said at all. But male universality is also a cause of the gender data gap, because women aren't seen and aren't remembered, because male data makes up the majority of what we know. What is male comes to be seen as universal. It leads to the positioning of women, half the global population, as a minority, with a niche identity and a subjective point of view. In such a framing, women are set up to be forgettable, ignorable, dispensable, from culture, from history, from data. And so, women become invisible. Invisible Women is the story of what happens when we forget to account for half of humanity. It is an exposé of how the gender data gap harms women when life proceeds, more or less, as normal. In urban planning, politics, the workplace. It is also about what happens to women living in a world built on male data when things go wrong. when they get sick, when they lose their home in a flood, when they have to flee that home because of war. But there is hope in this story too, because it's when women are able to step out from the shadows with their voices and their bodies that things start to shift. The gaps close. And so, at heart, Invisible Women is also a call for change. For too long, we have positioned women as a deviation from standard humanity, and this is why they have been allowed to become invisible. It's time for a change in perspective. It's time for women to be seen. Part 1. Daily Life. Chapter 1. Can snow clearing be sexist? It all started with a joke. It was 2011, and officials in the town of Karlskoga in Sweden were being hit with a gender equality initiative that meant they had to reevaluate all their policies through a gendered lens. As one after another of their policies was subjected to this harsh glare, one unfortunate official laughed that at least snow clearing was something the gender people would keep their noses out of. Unfortunately for him, his comment got the gender people thinking, is snow clearing sexist? At the time, in line with most administrations, snow clearing in Karlskoga began with the major traffic arteries and ended with pedestrian walkways and bicycle paths. But this was affecting men and women differently, because men and women travel differently. We lack consistent sex disaggregated data from every country, but the data we do have makes it clear that women are invariably more likely than men to walk and take public transport. In France, 2/3 of public transport passengers are women. In Philadelphia and Chicago in the US, the figure is 64% and 62%, respectively. Meanwhile, men around the world are more likely to drive. And if a household owns a car, it is the men who dominate access to it, even in the feminist utopia that is Sweden. And the differences don't stop at the mode of transport. It's also about why men and women are travelling. Men are most likely to have a fairly simple travel pattern, a twice-daily commute in and out of town. But women's travel patterns tend to be more complicated. Women do 75% of the world's unpaid care work, and this affects their travel needs. A typical female travel pattern involves, for example, dropping children off at school before going to work, taking an elderly relative to the doctor, and doing the grocery shopping on the way home. This is called trip chaining, a travel pattern of several small interconnected trips that has been observed in women around the world. In London, women are 3 times more likely than men to take a child to school and 25% more likely to trip chain. This figure rises to 39% if there is a child older than 9 in the household. The disparity in male-female trip chaining is found across Europe, where women in dual worker families are twice as likely as men to pick up and drop off children at school during their commute. It is most pronounced in households with young children. A working woman with a child under the age of 5 will increase her trip chaining by 54%. A working man in the same position will only increase his by 19%. What all these differences meant back in Karlskoga was that the apparently gender-neutral snow-clearing schedule was in fact not gender-neutral at all, so the town councillors switched the order of snow-clearing to prioritise pedestrians and public transport users. After all, they reasoned, it wouldn't cost any more money, and driving a car through 3 inches of snow is easier than pushing a buggy, or a wheelchair, or a bike through 3 inches of snow. What they didn't realise was that it would actually end up saving them money. Since 1985, Northern Sweden has been collecting data on hospital admissions for injuries. Their databases are dominated by pedestrians, who are injured 3 times more often than motorists in slippery or icy conditions, and account for half the hospital time of all traffic-related injuries. And the majority of these pedestrians are women. A study of pedestrian injuries in the Swedish city area of Umeå found that 79% occurred during the winter months, and that women made up 69% of those who had been injured in single-person incidents, that is, those which didn't involve anyone else. 2/3 of injured pedestrians had slipped and fallen on icy or snowy surfaces, and 48% had moderate to serious injuries, with fractures and dislocations being the most common. Women's injuries also tended to be more severe. A 5-year study in Skåne County uncovered the same trends and found that the injuries cost money in healthcare and lost productivity. The estimated cost of all these pedestrian falls during just a single winter season was 36 million kroner, around £3.2 million. This is likely to be a conservative estimate. Many injured pedestrians will visit hospitals that are not contributing to the National Traffic Accident Register. Some will visit doctors, and some will simply stay at home. As a result, both the healthcare and productivity costs are likely to be higher. But even with this conservative estimate, the cost of pedestrian accidents in icy conditions was about twice the cost of winter road maintenance. In Solna, near Stockholm, it was three times the cost, and some studies reveal it's even higher. Whatever the exact disparity, it is clear that preventing injuries by prioritising pedestrians in the snow clearing schedule makes economic sense. A brief snow clearing coda comes from the alt-right blogosphere, which reacted with glee when Stockholm failed to execute a smooth transfer to gender-equal snow clearing in 2016. An unusually high snowfall that year left roads and pavements covered in snow and commuters unable to get to work. But in their rush to celebrate the foundering of a feminist policy, what these right-wing commentators failed to note was that this system had already been working successfully in Karlskoga for 3 years. They also, in any case, reported the issue inaccurately. Heat Street claimed that the policy was a failure in part because injuries requiring a hospital visit reportedly spiked, neglecting to note that it was pedestrian injuries that had spiked, illustrating that the problem was not that pedestrians had been prioritised, but that snow clearing as a whole had not been conducted effectively. Motorists may not have been travelling well, but neither was anyone else. The following winter was much more successful. When I spoke to Daniel Helden, a local councillor in Stockholm's traffic department, he told me that on the 200 kilometres of joint cycle and pedestrian lanes that are now being cleared with special machines, which make them as clean as in the summer, accidents have gone down by half. So, it's a really good effect. The original snow clearing schedule in Karlskoga hadn't been deliberately designed to benefit men at the expense of women. Like many of the examples in this book, it came about as a result of a gender data gap. In this instance, a gap in perspective. The men, and it would have been men, who originally devised the schedule, knew how they travelled, and they designed around their needs. They didn't deliberately set out to exclude women, they just didn't think about them. They didn't think to consider if women's needs might be different. And so this data gap was a result of not involving women in planning. Inés Sánchez de Madriaga, an urban planning professor at Madrid's Technical University, tells me that this is a problem in transport planning more generally. Transport as a profession is highly male-dominated, she explains. In Spain, the Ministry of Transportation has the fewest women of all the ministries, both in political and technical positions, and so they have a bias from their personal experience. On the whole, engineers focus mostly on mobility related to employment. Fixed labour times create peak travel hours, and planners need to know the maximum capacity that infrastructure can support. So there's a technical reason for planning for peak hours, Sánchez de Madriaga acknowledges. But needing to plan for peak hours doesn't explain why female travel, which doesn't tend to fit into peak hours and therefore doesn't affect the maximum capacity of systems, gets ignored. The available research makes bias towards typically male modes of travel clear. The United Nations Commission on the Status of Women found a male bias in transport planning and a failure to address gender in system configuration. A 2014 EU report on European satisfaction with urban transport describes male travel patterns as standard, even as it decries the failure of European public transport systems to adequately serve women. More galling are common planning terms such as compulsory mobility, which Sánchez de Madriaga explains is a commonly used umbrella concept for all trips made for employment and educational purposes, as if care trips are not compulsory, but merely expendable me time for dilettantes. The bias is also clear in government spending priorities. Stephen Bush, the New Statesman's political correspondent, pointed out in a July 2017 article that although the Conservative government has consistently spouted austerity rhetoric, the last two Tory chancellors have made an exception for road building, on which both have spent lavishly. With living standards falling and Britain already having a fairly serviceable road infrastructure, there is a whole host of areas that seem a potentially wiser investment. But somehow, both times, for both men, roads have seemed the obvious choice. Meanwhile, by 2014, 70% of councils had cut bus funding, the most feminised form of transport, with a £19 million cut in 2013 alone, and bus prices have been rising every year. British politicians are not alone here. A 2007 World Bank report revealed that 73% of World Bank transport funding is for roads and highways, most of them rural or linking up cities. Even where roads are the right investment choice, where the proposed road leads is not a gender-neutral decision. In an illustration of how important it is that development projects are based on sex-disaggregated data, another World Bank report recounted the disagreement over a proposed road in one village in Lesotho. Women wanted the road to be constructed in one direction to facilitate their access to the nearest village with basic services. Men wanted it built in the opposite direction, to enable them to reach the larger town and market more easily on horseback. The gender gap in travel data continues with the intentional omission in many transport surveys of shorter pedestrian and other non-motorised trips. These trips, says Sanchez de Madriaga, are not considered to be relevant for infrastructure policymaking. Given women generally walk further and for longer than men, in part because of their caregiving responsibilities, in part because women tend to be poorer, this marginalisation of non-motorised travel inevitably affects them more. Ignoring shorter walking trips also adds to the gap in trip chaining data, as this kind of travel usually involves at least one journey on foot. In short, the assumption that shorter walking trips are irrelevant to infrastructure policy is a little short of an assumption that women are irrelevant to infrastructure policy. But they aren't. Men tend to travel on their own, but women travel encumbered by shopping, by buggies, by children or elderly relatives they are caring for. A 2015 survey on travel in London found that women are significantly less likely than men to be satisfied with the streets and pavements after their last journey by foot, perhaps reflecting the reality that not only are women more likely to walk than men, but also that women are more likely to be pushing prams and therefore be more affected by inadequate walkways. Rough, narrow and cracked pavements littered with ill-placed street furniture combine with narrow and steep steps at numerous transit locations to make travelling around a city with a buggy extremely difficult, says Sanchez de Madriaga, who estimates that it can take up to four times as long. So what do young women with small kids do? Valuing cars over pedestrians is not inevitable. In Vienna, 60% of all journeys are made on foot, in no small part because the city takes gender planning seriously. Since the 1990s, Vienna's head of gender planning, Eva Keil, has been collecting data on pedestrian travel and has installed the following improvements: improved and signed crossing locations, plus 40 additional crossings, retrofitted steps with ramps for prams and bikes, widened 1,000 metres of pavement, and increased pedestrian street lighting. The mayor of Barcelona, Ada Colau, has shown similar determination to give her city back to pedestrians, creating what are called superilles, or superblocks, squared-off sections of the city with low speed limits open only to local traffic, with roads where pedestrians have equal priority with cars. Another example of easy changes that can be implemented to accommodate female travel patterns comes via London, where in 2016 the Hop Affair was introduced to the bus network. Previously, every time a user boarded a bus, they were charged for a new journey. But under the new system, users can now make two trips in 1 hour for the price of one. This change is particularly helpful for women because they were disproportionately penalised by the old charging system. This is not only because of women being more likely to trip chain, but also because women make up the majority, 57%, of London's bus users, partly because it's cheaper, partly because the bus is perceived as more child-friendly and are more likely to have to transfer, which under the old system counted as a new trip. The reason women are more likely to have to transfer is because, like most cities around the world, London's public transport system is radial. What this means is that a single downtown area has been identified, and the majority of routes lead there. There will be some circular routes concentrated in the centre. The whole thing looks rather like a spider's web, and it is incredibly useful for commuters who just want to get in and out of the centre of town. It is, however, less useful for everything else. And this useful, not so useful binary falls rather neatly onto the male-female binary. But while solutions like London's Hop Affair are an improvement, they are by no means standard practice worldwide. In the US, while some cities have abandoned charging for transfers, LA stopped doing this in 2014, others are sticking with it. Chicago, for example, still charges for public transport connections. These charges seem particularly egregious in light of a 2016 study which revealed quite how much Chicago's transport system is biased against typical female travel patterns. The study, which compared UberPool, the car-sharing version of the popular taxi app, with public transport in Chicago, revealed that for trips downtown, the difference in time between UberPool and public transport was negligible, around 6 minutes on average. But for trips between neighbourhoods, i.e. the type of travel women are likely to be making for informal work or caregiving responsibilities, UberPool took 28 minutes to make a trip that took 47 minutes on public transport. Given women's time poverty, women's paid and unpaid work combines into a longer working day than men's, UberPool might seem attractive, except it costs around three times more than public transport, and women are also cash poor compared to men, Around the world, women have less access to household finances than men, while the global gender pay gap currently stands at 37.8%. It varies hugely from country to country, being 18.1% in the UK, 23% in Australia, and 59.6% in Angola. There is, of course, an issue of resources here, but the problem is, to a certain extent, one of attitude and priorities. Although McKinsey estimates that women's unpaid care work contributes $10 trillion to annual global GDP, trips made for paid work are still valued more than trips made for unpaid care work. But when I ask Sanchez de Madriaga if, in a city like London or Madrid, there is an economic argument for providing transport that caters for women's care responsibilities, she replied immediately, "Absolutely. Women's employment is a really important input to GDP. For every percentage increase in women's employment, there is a greater increase in GDP. But for women to work, the city has to support this work. And one of the key ways to do this is to design transport systems that enable women to do their unpaid work and still get to the office on time." When it comes to fixed infrastructure like subways and trains, Sanchez de Madriaga explains, there is not really much you can easily or cheaply do to address this historical bias. You can improve their accessibility, she says, and that's about it. Buses, on the other hand, are flexible, and their routes and stops can and should be moved and adjusted for need, says Sanchez de Madriaga. This is, in fact, what Ada Colau has done in Barcelona by introducing a new orthogonal bus route, a grid rather than a spiderweb, which is more useful for trip chaining. Sanchez de Madriaga also argues that public transport needs to develop intermediate services, something between a car and a bus. In Mexico, they have something called terceros, which are really small, like a mini bus. And they have shared taxis. These have a lot of flexibility and, I think, could and should be developed to support women's mobility. While much of the historical gender data gap in travel planning has arisen simply because the idea that women might have different needs didn't occur to the mainly male planners, there is another less excusable reason for it, and that is that women are seen as, well, just more difficult to measure. Women have much more complicated travel patterns, explains Sanchez de Madriaga, who has designed a survey to measure women's care travel. And on the whole, transport authorities aren't interested in women's atypical travel habits. Anastasia Lukaitu-Sederis, a professor of urban planning at UCLA, tells me that oftentimes there is the perception from the part of transit operators that everyone has universal needs. Men, women, everything is the same. And this is completely untrue. She laughs in exasperation. Talking to women riders, they bring up a whole slew of different needs that are not being taken care of. To make matters worse, transport authorities are compounding the existing gender data gap by failing to separate the data they do have by sex. The annual transport statistics report, created by the UK government's Department of Transport, includes a single statistic on the gender breakdown of driving test pass rates. In 2015 to 16, 44% of women passed versus 51% of men, and a link to a page on a government website that hosts a report on gender and walking. The report has nothing to say on the gender breakdown of bus or rail usage, for example, even though this information is vital for planning a transport system that properly serves all its users. India's public transport agencies also don't separate their data by sex. While a recent EU report bemoaned the paucity of gender-sensitive transport data, explaining that this kind of data is not collected on a regular basis in the majority of European countries. As in the UK, the US's Transport Statistics Annual Report only mentions women twice. Once in relation to driving licenses and once in relation to walking. Unlike the UK, however, these references are not even presented as usable statistics, just generalised statements. A more hidden data gap comes courtesy of the way transport agencies around the world present their data. On the whole, all travel for paid work is grouped together into one single category, but care work is subdivided into smaller categories, some of which, like shopping, aren't distinguished from leisure. This is failing to sex disaggregate by proxy. When Sanchez de Madriaga collected care-related travel data in Madrid, she found that the number of trips made for caring purposes almost equaled those made for employment purposes. And when she further refined the data by sex disaggregating it, she found that care was the single and foremost purpose of travel for women in much the same way as employment is the main purpose of men's travel. If all travel surveys were to do this, she argues, planners would be forced to take care travel as seriously as employment travel. If we really want to start designing transport systems that serve women as well as men, it's no good designing transport infrastructure in isolation, cautions Sanchez de Madriaga, because women's mobility is also an issue of overarching planning policy, specifically the creation of mixed-use areas. And mixed-use areas fly in the face of traditional planning norms that, in many countries, legally divide cities into commercial, residential, and industrial single-use areas, a practice that is called zoning. Zoning dates back to antiquity, what was allowed on either side of the city walls, for example. But it wasn't until the Industrial Revolution that we started to see the kind of explicit division of what could be built where that legally separated where you live from where you might work. And, with its oversimplified categories, this kind of zoning has woven a male bias into the fabric of cities around the world. Zoning laws are based on, and prioritise the needs of, a breadwinning, heterosexual, married man who goes off to work in the morning and comes home to the suburbs to relax at night. This is, explains Sanchez de Madriaga, the personal reality of most decision makers in the field, and the idea that the home is mostly a place for leisure continues to underpin planning practices throughout the world. But if for these decision makers the home is a respite from paid labour and a place for leisure, that is far from its role in most women's lives. Globally, women do 3 times the amount of unpaid care work men do. According to the IMF, this can be further subdivided into twice as much childcare and 4 times as much housework. In Katebe, a town in central Uganda, the World Bank found that after spending nearly 15 hours on a combination of housework, childcare, digging, preparing food, collecting fuel and water, women were unsurprisingly left with only around 30 minutes of leisure time per day. By contrast, men, who spent an hour less than women per day digging, negligible amounts of time on housework and childcare, and no time at all on collecting fuel and water, managed to find about 4 hours per day to spend on leisure. The home may have been a place of leisure for him, but for her, not so much. In any case, in most families, both parents work, and with women in heterosexual couples being the most likely to have primary caring responsibilities over children and elderly relatives, the legal separation of the home from formal workplaces can make life incredibly difficult. Those who have to accompany children and sick relatives around the peripheries of an urban area poorly served by public transport infrastructure are forgotten. The truth is that most zoning ordinances do not reflect women's lives, or even many men's lives. The impact of the kind of lazy unthinking that positions the home as a place of leisure can be severe. In 2009, Brazil launched a public housing scheme called Minha Casa, Minha Vida, My House, My Life. The plan was to help those, at the time an estimated 50 million people, living in inadequate housing. It hasn't exactly worked out that way. The stereotypical image of Brazil's favelas is one of substandard slums, of crime-ridden areas of poverty and lawlessness, where cowed residents live in fear of prowling gangs. There is a grain of truth to this stereotype, but for many favela residents, the reality is very different, and the homes they live in are simply the community-built social housing the state has failed to provide. They have grown in response to need and are generally located in convenient locations for both work and transport. The same cannot be said for the Minha Casa Minha Vida, MCMV complexes, which have mostly been built on the far edges of the West Zone, an area which in 2010 was described by Antonio Augusto Verissimo, director of Rio's housing ministry, as a região dormitorio, a dormant region, because of its lack of jobs. In fact, Verissimo discouraged the building of public housing in this area for fear of creating mais guetos de pobreza, more ghettos of poverty. Research from the London School of Economics has also found that the majority of those who have resettled have been moved much further from their original homes than the 7 kilometres distance allowed under municipal law. Luisa, 42, used to live in a favela in Rio's wealthy South Zone, where, along with the Central and North Zones, the majority of jobs in Rio are to be found. "I walked out of my door and was practically already at work," she told a researcher for the Heinrich Boll Foundation. "There was transportation going everywhere. I didn't have to walk for miles just to get to a bus stop." She now lives in an MCMV condo in Campo Grande, in Rio's underdeveloped West Zone, more than 50 kilometres away from her old home. With no jobs in the immediate vicinity, residents must travel up to 3 hours to the north and central zones using a transport infrastructure that can be described as limited at best. Over 60% of the new housing units are a 30-minute walk from the nearest train or metro. and the failure to provide adequate public transport for those relocated from the centre to the outskirts of Rio impacts on women in particular because Rio follows the global trend of men dominating car ownership. 71% of cars are owned by men, and men are twice as likely as women to travel using individual vehicles. It also particularly impacts on women because of their unpaid care work responsibilities. Melissa Fernandez-Arigoitia, a researcher at LSE, told me about the panic of a woman she interviewed who had just been told that she was being moved to an MCMV complex. Pregnant and already a mother of two, she was only able to work because she could rely on her mother for childcare. Being moved 70 kilometres away from her mother and her workplace would make keeping her job impossible. And in the new MCMV complexes, what little childcare provision exists has not been renovated or expanded to attend to the new residents. The failure to provide childcare is exacerbated by the design of the government's new complexes. The apartments themselves have been designed for traditional nuclear families, but the nuclear family is by no means the standard family unit in a favela. It's very rare that you go into a home in a favela and there aren't three generations living there, says Dr. Teresa Williamson, a Rio-based urban planning expert, adding that she's never seen an elderly person living on their own in a favela. Similarly, the majority of the households Arigoitia interviewed were single mothers, often with both children and an older parent living with them. But the standardised designs of these super tiny housing units didn't respond at all to the potential variety of families, and a side effect is that the childcare solution that intergenerational favela living often provides has been excluded from the new complexes by design. As for public space in the MCMV complexes, this is more or less limited to huge car parks, despite the fact that very few people have cars, and horribly maintained playgrounds, with equipment that is so cheap it is destroyed within a couple of months and not replaced. The complexes seem designed with privacy rather than community in mind. For the families used to the intimacy of the favela, where, explains Williamson, your kid doesn't necessarily even need childcare after a certain age because everybody is always watching them, this often translates into isolation and fear of crime. The upshot is that kids aren't outside as much, they stay in their apartments. And suddenly women do need to be watching their kids in a way they didn't used to in the favela. Suddenly they need childcare, and they don't have any. This isn't even an issue of resources, it's an issue of priorities. Brazil spent millions on public transport infrastructure in the run-up to the 2014 World Cup and 2016 Olympics. The money was there, it was just being spent elsewhere. LSE City's research found that the new bus rapid transit corridors tended to privilege areas where Olympic facilities were located, leaving the problem of collective transport between the poorer resettlements and downtown unattended. Furthermore, according to residents, government relocation priorities seemed to be less about helping those who needed better housing and more about making way for the upcoming World Cup and Olympics infrastructure development. And so the women pay. Christine Santos lost her job in a market in Nova Iguaçu after she was moved to the Vivenda das Patativas complex in Campo Grande. I had to take three buses, she explained. Another woman was so exhausted from her daily commute of up to 6 hours that she had a near-fatal car accident. With few other options open to them, women have taken to setting up shop in their new homes, selling drinks, preparing lunch plates, cutting people's hair. But they have to do it in the knowledge that it could get them evicted, because in doing so, they are flouting zoning regulations. Turning your home into your workplace is an option in favela living because there are no zoning regulations in place. The whole area is already technically illegal. This is not the case with the government's public housing, where, being a residential zone, running a business from your home is strictly forbidden. So, to sum up, the Brazilian government moved women away from the formal workplace, and indeed the informal workplace, women dominate Brazil's 7.2 million domestic workers, and provided them with inadequate public transport and no childcare. In so doing, they practically forced women to turn their homes into their workplace by making this the one option that is realistically open to them. And they've made it illegal. Public housing doesn't have to be this way, but the alternative does require thought. When Vienna's public officials decided to build a new housing complex in 1993, they first defined the needs of the people using the space and then looked for technical solutions to meet those needs, explains Eva Kyle. What this meant was collecting data, specifically sex disaggregated data, because the people this housing was intended to serve were women. Surveys compiled at the time by Austria's National Statistics Agency revealed that women spent more time per day than men on household chores and childcare. According to the latest World Economic Forum figures, Austrian women spend double the time men spend on unpaid work, and more time overall on paid and unpaid work combined. And so, explains Kyle, officials designed the housing complex Frauen Work Stadt 1, Women Work City 1, there has since been a 2 and a 3, to cater for women's caring needs. First came the location, which, Kyle says, was carefully chosen to make it easier for women to carry out their caring responsibilities. The complex is right next to a tram stop, has a kindergarten on site, and is close to schools, meaning children can travel on their own from an early age. Sanchez de Madriaga tells me that one of the biggest time drains for women is escorting kids to school, to doctors, and to extracurricular activities. A doctor's practice, a pharmacy, and commercial space for other shops are all included within the complex, and there is a large supermarket nearby. It is the ultimate in mixed-use design. The design of FWS 1 is, in fact, rather like a purpose-built favela. It prioritizes community and shared space. Interconnected buildings with a maximum of 4 units per floor stand around a series of shared courtyards, complete with grassy areas and children's play spaces, which are visible from any unit in the project. Meanwhile, transparent stairwells visible to the outdoors, high levels of lighting in public spaces, and well-lit car parking accessible only via flats were all designed to promote a sense of safety. Another housing complex in Vienna, Autofrei Mustersiedlung, dispensed with parking spaces altogether, bypassing the zoning rule that specifies 1 car parking space per new apartment. They instead spent the money on communal rooms and additional play areas. The complex was not specifically aimed at women, but given women are less likely to drive and more likely to care for children than men, the outcome is nevertheless one that caters to women's housing and care needs. Care work is also built into the interior of the open floor plan FWS1 flats. The kitchen is at the heart of each flat, its visible lines of sight to the rest of the home mirroring the outer courtyard design. This not only enables women to keep an eye on children while working in the kitchen, it also places housework at the heart of the house, a subtle challenge to the idea that housework is solely a woman's responsibility. Compare this to the tendency a local official in Philadelphia revealed she had to repeatedly check in developers of putting kitchens up on a third floor with no elevator. Do you want to carry your groceries and strollers up to the third floor? She points out. Chapter 2. Gender neutral with urinals. In April 2017, veteran BBC journalist Samira Ahmed wanted to use a toilet. She was at a screening of I Am Not Your Negro at London's famous Barbican Arts Centre, and it was the interval. Any woman who has ever been to the theatre knows what this means. A rush as soon as the lights go up to try to beat the inevitable queue that will soon be snaking its way across the foyer floor. Women are used to queuing when they go out. It's frustrating and puts a dampener on their evening. No nice interval chit-chat about the show with friends over a drink. Just dull, tedious lining up, occasionally leavened by the knowing eye rolls they share with their fellow waiting women. But this evening was different. This evening, the queue was worse than usual. Far worse. Because in an almost comically blatant display of not having thought about women at all, the Barbican had turned both the male and female toilets gender neutral simply by replacing the men and women signage with gender neutral with urinals and gender neutral with cubicles. The obvious happened. Only men were using the supposedly gender neutral with urinals and everyone was using the gender neutral with cubicles. Rather than rendering the toilets actually gender neutral by this move, they had simply increased the provision for men. Women are generally not able to use urinals, while men are, of course, able to use both urinals and cubicles. There were also no sanitary bins in the gender-neutral with urinals toilets. Ah, the irony of having to explain discrimination having just been to see I Am Not Your Negro in your cinema, Ahmed tweeted, suggesting that the solution would be to turn the gents into gender-neutral loos. There's never such a queue there, and you know it. Although this truism seems to have passed the Barbican's heavily male-dominated management team by, it is true that the perennial queuing problem is one that men do tend to know about. Given it so often spills out of the main bathroom door, it's hard for even the most oblivious man to miss. But fewer people, men or women, know exactly why it happens. There is a tendency, as ever, to blame the women rather than the male-biased design. But male-biased design is in fact exactly what the problem is here. On the face of it, it may seem fair and equitable to accord male and female public toilets the same amount of floor space, and historically, this is the way it has been done. 50-50 division of floor space has even been formalised in plumbing codes. However, If a male toilet has both cubicles and urinals, the number of people who can relieve themselves at once is far higher per square foot of floor space in the male bathroom than in the female bathroom. Suddenly, equal floor space isn't so equal. But even if male and female toilets had an equal number of stalls, the issue wouldn't be resolved because women take up to 2.3 times as long as men to use the toilet. Women make up the majority of the elderly and disabled, two groups that will tend to need more time in the toilet. Women are also more likely to be accompanied by children, as well as disabled and older people. Then there's the 20 to 25% of women of childbearing age who may be on their period at any one time, and therefore needing to change a tampon or a sanitary pad. Women may also in any case require more trips to the bathroom than men. Pregnancy significantly reduces bladder capacity, and women are 8 times more likely to suffer from urinary tract infections than men, which again increases the frequency with which a toilet visit is needed. In the face of all these anatomical differences, it would surely take a formal, rather than substantive, equality dogmatist to continue to argue that equal floor space between men and women is fair. It gets a lot worse than supposedly equal provision being in fact male-biased. A third of the world's population lack adequate toilet provision at all. According to the UN, 1 in 3 women lack access to safe toilets, and WaterAid reports that girls and women collectively spend 97 billion hours a year finding a safe place to relieve themselves. The lack of adequate toilet provision is a public health problem for both sexes. For example, in India, where 60% of the population does not have access to a toilet, 90% of surface water is contaminated. But the problem is particularly acute for women, in no small part because of the attitude that men can go anywhere, while for women to be seen urinating is shameful. Women get up before dawn and then wait for hours until dusk to go out again in search of a relatively private place to urinate or defecate. And this isn't just a problem in poor countries. Human Rights Watch spoke to young girls working in tobacco fields in America and found that they would refrain from relieving themselves at all during the day, aided by avoiding drinking liquids, which increased their risk of dehydration and heat illness. This affects women's paid labour. Women make up 91% of the 86% of Indians who work in the informal economy. Many of these women work as market vendors, and no public toilets means they have nowhere to go during the workday. In Afghanistan, female police officers go to the toilets in pairs because their changing and toilet facilities, described by an international advisor to Human Rights Watch as a site of harassment, often have peepholes or doors which don't lock. The lack of safe toilet provision, in fact, often prevents women from joining the force at all, and this in turn has had a significant impact on how the police respond to crimes against women and girls. Despite women's arguably greater need for public sanitary facilities, however, men are often the ones who are better provided for. More than half of Mumbai's 5 million women do not have an indoor toilet, and there are no free public toilets for women. Meanwhile, free urinals for men run into the thousands. A typical Mumbai slum might have 6 bathrooms for 8,000 women. And government figures from 2014 revealed that the city as a whole has 3,536 public restrooms that women share with men, but not a single women's-only facility, not even in some police stations and courts. A 2015 survey found that 12.5% of women in Mumbai's slums defecate in the open at night. They prefer to take this risk to walking 58 metres, the average distance of the community toilet from their homes. But defecating in the open isn't really much safer for women. There is a real danger of sexual assault from men who lurk near and on the routes to areas which are known to be used by women when they need to relieve themselves. The level of violation ranges from voyeurism, including being masturbated at, to rape, and in extreme cases, to murder. Accurate data on the level of sexual harassment and assault faced by women as they seek to engage in what should be a mundane activity is hard to come by, in no small degree because of the shame surrounding the issue. Few women are willing to talk about something they may well be blamed for encouraging. But what data does exist makes it clear that a failure to provide adequate sanitation is a feminist issue. A 2016 study found that Indian women who use fields to relieve themselves are twice as likely to face non-partner sexual violence as women with a household toilet. Following the 2014 murder of 2 girls aged 12 and 14 in Uttar Pradesh, there was a brief flurry of national focus on the lack of adequate toilet provision for women, and in December 2014, Bombay's High Court ordered all municipal corporations to provide safe and clean toilets for women near main roads. 96 potential sites were identified, and Bombay's local government promised 50 million rupees, around £550,000, to build new toilets. But a year later, reported online women's rights magazine Broadly, not a single brick had been laid. The fund allocation lapsed in 2016. Local governments that fail to provide public toilets may believe that they are cutting costs, but a 2015 Yale study suggests that this is a false economy. The study authors developed a mathematical model linking the risk of sexual assault to the number of sanitation facilities and the time a woman must spend walking to a toilet, and calculated the tangible costs, lost earnings, medical, court and prison expenses, and intangible costs, pain and suffering, risk of homicide, of sexual assault, versus the cost of installing and maintaining toilets. They applied their model to Khayelitsha, a township in South Africa, which has an estimated 5,600 toilets for a population of 2.4 million, resulting, the authors claimed, in 635 sexual assaults at a cost of $40 million each year. Increasing the number of toilets to 11,300 at a direct cost of $12 million would almost half the average distance to a toilet and result in a 30% decrease in sexual assault. According to the mathematical model, the reduced social and policing costs more than offset the additional cost of providing toilets, leaving the township $5 million better off. These figures, they added, were conservative, since their costings had not included the many additional health benefits of improving sanitation in resource-constrained urban areas. And there are many additional health benefits, particularly for women. Women get bladder and urinary tract infections from holding in their urine. Others suffer from dehydration or chronic constipation. Women who defecate outdoors are at risk of a range of infections and diseases, including pelvic inflammatory disease, worm infections, hepatitis, diarrhea, cholera, polio, and waterborne diseases. Some of these diseases kill millions of people, particularly women and children, every year in India alone. Health problems arising from a lack of public sanitary provision are not restricted to low-income countries. Canadian and British studies have revealed that referrals for urinary tract infections, problems with distended bladders, and a range of other urogynecological problems have increased proportionately to toilet closure. Similarly, research shows that the chances of streptococcal toxic shock syndrome from sanitary protection are increased if there are no toilets available to change tampons during menstruation. And increasingly, there isn't a toilet available. A 2007 study revealed that public toilet closure in the US has been a trend for over half a century. In the UK, 50% of public toilets were closed between 1995 and 2013, or, as in the public toilet closest to where I live in London, converted into the proverbial hipster bar. Urban planning that fails to account for women's risk of being sexually assaulted is a clear violation of women's equal right to public spaces, and inadequate sanitary provision is only one of the many ways planners exclude women with this kind of gender-insensitive design. Women are often scared in public spaces. In fact, they are around twice as likely to be scared as men. And, rather unusually, we have the data to prove it. Crime surveys and empirical studies from different parts of the world show that a majority of women are fearful of the potential violence against them when in public spaces, explains urban planning professor Anastasia Lukaitu Sideris. Analysis of crime data from the US and Sweden both show that women and men respond to similar environmental conditions differently, with women tending to be more sensitive than men to signs of danger and social disorder, graffiti, and unkempt and abandoned buildings. A UK Department for Transport study highlighted the stark difference between male and female perceptions of danger, finding that 62% of women are scared walking in multi-storey car parks, 60% are scared waiting on train platforms, 49% are scared waiting at the bus stop, and 59% are scared walking home from a bus stop or station. The figures for men are 31%, 25%, 20%, and 25%, respectively. Fear of crime is particularly high among low-income women, partly because they tend to live in areas with higher crime rates, but also because they are likely to be working odd hours and often come home from work in the dark. Ethnic minority women tend to experience more fear for the same reasons, as well as having the added danger of, often gendered, racialized violence to contend with. This fear impacts on women's mobility and their basic right of access to the city. Studies from Finland, Sweden, the United States, Canada, Taiwan, and the UK all show that women adjust their behavior and their travel patterns to accommodate this fear. They avoid specific routes, times, and modes of transport. They avoid travelling at night. In one Canadian study, exactly half of the women surveyed indicated that fear prevents them from using public transportation or parking garages. And studies from around the world find that fear of crime is amongst the most important reasons women choose not to use public transport. If they can afford to, they choose to drive or take a taxi instead. The trouble is, many of them can't afford to. Most passengers are transit captives, meaning that they have no reasonable means other than public transport to get from one place to another. This lack of choice particularly affects low-income women and those living in the global south. In India, for example, women have limited access to private transport and therefore rely on public transport to a far greater extent than men. These women adopt strategies such as taking a longer roundabout route or only travelling while accompanied. Some women go as far as quitting their jobs, a solution that is not limited to those on low incomes. When I tweeted about women's experiences of harassment on public transport, one man replied to tell me about a very intelligent and capable woman he knows who gave up a really good job in the city and moved out of London because she hated being groped on the tube. Clearly, there is an injustice here. But all too often, the blame is put on women themselves for feeling fearful, rather than on planners for designing urban spaces and transit environments that make them feel unsafe. And, as usual, the gender data gap is behind it all. The official statistics show that men are in fact more likely to be victims of crime in public spaces, including public transport. And this paradox, says Lukaitu Sideris, has led to the conclusion that women's fear of crime is irrational and more of a problem than crime itself. But, she points out, the official statistics do not tell the whole story. As women navigate public spaces, they are also navigating a slew of threatening sexual behaviours. Before we even get to the more serious offences like being assaulted, women are dealing on a daily basis with behaviours from men that make, and are often calculated to make, them feel uncomfortable. Ranging from catcalling to being leered at to the use of sexualised slurs and requests for someone's name, none of these behaviours is criminal exactly, but they all add up to a feeling of sexual menace, a feeling of being watched, of being in danger, and in fact these behaviours can easily escalate. Enough women have experienced the sharp shift from, smile love, it might never happen, to, fuck you bitch, why are you ignoring me, to being followed home and assaulted, to know that an innocent comment from a male stranger can be anything but. But women don't report these behaviours, because who could they report them to? Until the emergence of groups like Everyday Sexism and Hollaback, which give women a space in which they can talk about the intimidating but just short of criminal behaviours they face in public spaces on a daily basis, public awareness of this behaviour was more or less non-existent. When police in Nottingham started recording misogynistic behaviour, everything from indecent exposure to groping to upskirting, as a hate crime, or if the behaviour was not strictly criminal, a hate incident, they found reports shot up. Not because men had suddenly got much worse, but because women felt that they would be taken seriously. The invisibility of the threatening behaviour women face in public is compounded by the reality that men don't do this to women who are accompanied by other men, who are in any case also much less likely to experience this kind of behaviour. A recent Brazilian survey found that 2/3 of women had been victims of sexual harassment and violence while in transit, half of them on public transportation. The proportion among men was 18%. So men who didn't do it, and didn't experience it, simply didn't know it was going on. And they all too often dismissed women who told them about it with an airy, well, I've never seen it, another gender data gap. And one that is exacerbated by how we collect the data. Large-scale data for the prevalence of sexual harassment is lacking, explains a 2017 paper, not only because of underreporting, but also because it is often not included in crime statistics. Added to this is the problem that sexual harassment is often poorly classified, with many studies failing to either define harassment or codify harassment types. In 2014, the Australia Institute found that 87% of the women surveyed had experienced verbal or physical street harassment, but data concerning the extent or form of incidences were not collected. The apparent mismatch between women's fear and the level of violence the official statistics say they experience is not just about the general stew of menace women are navigating. Women also aren't reporting the more serious offences. A 2016 survey of sexual harassment in the Washington, D.C. metro found that 77% of those who were harassed never reported, which is around the same level found by Inmujeres, a Mexican government agency that campaigns on violence against women. The reporting rate is even lower in New York City, with an estimated 96% of sexual harassment and 86% of sexual assaults in the subway system going unreported, while in London, where a fifth of women have reportedly been physically assaulted while using public transport, a 2017 study found that around 90% of people who experienced unwanted sexual behaviour would not report it. An NGO survey of female metro users in Baku, Azerbaijan, found that none of the women who said they had been sexually harassed reported it to the appropriate authority. Clearly, then, official police data is not showing the full picture. But although there is a lack of global data on the exact nature, location, and time of sexual crimes against women in public spaces, a growing body of research shows that women are, in fact, not being irrational. From Rio to Los Angeles, men have raped women and girls on buses while drivers carry blithely along their routes. "The truth is that every time I leave my house, I am scared," says Victoria Juarez, a 34-year-old woman from Mexico, where 9 in 10 women have experienced sexual harassment while using public transport, and female workers report that men hang around in cars to kidnap women getting on and off buses. Travelling to and from work is, they say, the most dangerous part of their day. A 2016 study found that 90% of French women had been victims of sexual harassment on public transport. In May that year, 2 men were jailed for an attempted gang rape on a Paris train. A 2016 Washington Metro survey found that women were 3 times more likely than men to face harassment on public transport. In April that year, a suspect was identified in an indecent exposure incident on the Washington Metro. A month later, he had escalated to raping a woman at knife point on a train. In October 2017, another repeat offender was arrested on the Washington Metro. He had targeted the same victim twice. "The message is unanimous across all articles of this special issue," wrote Professor of Urban Planning Vania Cecato in her afterword to a 2017 special issue of the academic journal Crime Prevention and Community Safety, Women's Victimization and Safety in Transit Environments, Sexual Crime Against Women in Transit, Cases of Staring, Touching, Groping, Ejaculation, Exposing Genitalia, and Full Rape is a highly underreported offence. Women don't report for a variety of reasons. Some of these are societal: stigma, shame, concern that they'll be blamed or disbelieved. And there is little that authorities can do about this. That change has to come from society itself. But many women don't report for more prosaic issues that can be far more easily addressed. For a start, women often aren't sure exactly what counts as sexual harassment and are afraid of the response of authorities. Assuming they do realise what has happened is wrong, they often don't know who it is they have to report to. Around the world, there is a lack of clear information for women on what to do if they are sexually harassed or assaulted on public transport, although most authorities seem to have managed to install clear signage about what to do in the event of spotting a suspicious package. Sometimes, though, the lack of signage is because there really aren't any procedures in place. And this leads to the next problem: the experiences of women who do report. In 2017, a British woman tweeted about what happened when she reported a man who was sexually harassing her on a bus. After asking her what she expected him to do, the bus driver commented, "You're a pretty girl. What do you expect?" Her experience echoes that of a 26-year-old woman riding a bus in Delhi. "It was around 9 p.m. A man standing behind touched me inappropriately. I shouted and caught the guy by his collar. I made the driver stop the bus too. But I was told to get off and solve it myself because other passengers were getting late." Fear of being dismissed was why Sarah Hayward, a former local councillor for my borough in London, didn't report. "I was felt up on a packed tube train when I was about 22. I can't begin to explain the absolute terror of that feeling, and I just knew that if I said anything, people would think it was just that the tube was packed." The irony is, the tube having been packed may well have been a factor in what happened to her. The data we have suggests that peak travel times coincide with peak sexual harassment times. Hayward tells me that she still tries to avoid the tube in rush hour. The lack of reporting procedures for sexual assault is also a problem in the sky. A 2016 Slate article told the story of Diana T., who, mid-flight between the US and Germany, woke up to find a hand squeezing her breast hard. It belonged to the man sitting next to her. She told cabin crew, who initially tried to make her sit back down. Eventually, they gave her a seat in business class, but although many of the crew were sympathetic, no one seemed to know what to do. When they landed, the man simply got off the plane and went on his way. A similar story emerged in 2017. American Airlines crew refused to move a woman to another seat when it became clear the man next to her was masturbating. The first step for transit authorities, which have a hugely male-dominated workforce from top to bottom, is to accept that they have a problem. When Lukaitu Sideris wanted to find out how US transit agencies address women's safety on public transport, she came across a gender data gap. She found only two papers from the 1990s, neither of which looked at the security needs of female passengers, and which in any case were redundant, given the huge changes that have been made to transport security post 9/11. There was a more recent paper from 2005, but it focused primarily on the response of US transit agencies to the threat of terrorism, and did not investigate women's concerns or their specific security needs. So Lukaitu Sideris conducted her own survey, and she encountered some resistance from the male-dominated workforce she surveyed. "You're assuming that the world is less safe for females," replied the male chief operating officer of one agency. The male safety and security manager of another insisted that safety and security issues and concerns are non-gender specific. And in a clear example of the damage the gender data gap does, another male safety and security officer refuted the need for gendered planning on the basis that statistical data for our system does not show females have a greater risk. Once they have accepted that they have a problem, step two for transport planners is to design evidence-based solutions. Of the 131 transit agencies, more than half of all the large and medium-sized transit operators in the US that responded to Lukaitu Sideris' survey, only one-third felt that transit agencies should really do something about it, and only three agencies had actually done anything about it. Perhaps unsurprisingly, given the chronic lack of data and research on women's safety in transport settings, Lukaitu Sideris also found a significant mismatch between the safety and security needs and desires of female passengers and the types and locations of strategies that transit agencies use. Most of the agencies she surveyed had security strategies on their buses. 80% had CCTV, 76% had panic alarms, and 73% had public address systems. But the vast majority neither had, nor intended to install, security measures at bus stops. This is in diametric opposition to what women actually want. They are far more likely to feel scared waiting in the dark at a bus stop than they are to feel scared on the bus itself. And in fact, they are right to feel this way. One study found that people were over three times more likely to be a victim of crime at or near a transit stop than on the vehicle itself. The type of security transport agencies install also matters, and there is also a mismatch here. Transit agencies, possibly for cost reasons, vastly prefer technological solutions to hiring security officers. There is little available data on what impact CCTV has on harassment, but certainly repeated studies have found that women are deeply sceptical of its use, vastly preferring the presence of a conductor or security guard. That is, a preventative solution, as opposed to a blinking light in the corner which may or may not be monitored miles away. Interestingly, men prefer technological solutions to the presence of guards, perhaps because the types of crime they are more likely to experience are less personally violating. But if paying for a full-time guard is expensive, although arguably worth it if it increases women's use of public transport, there are plenty of cheaper solutions available. Lukaitu Sideris tells me that the city of Portland has a digital timetable in the bus stop, so you know when the next bus is going to come, meaning women don't have to wait for ages in the dark simply because they don't know the next bus is half an hour away. I admit, when I heard this presented as a radical solution, I was shocked. In London, it's far more unusual to come across a bus stop without a digital timetable. Other evidence-based solutions include transparent bus shelters for better visibility and increased lighting, not just at bus stops and metro stations themselves, but on the route to them. The location of the bus stop is also important. Sometimes even moving the bus stops a few feet up or down the block if it is in front of a well-used establishment can make all the difference, says Lukaitu Sideris. My personal favourite approach is the introduction of request stops in between official stops for women travelling on night buses. Although women make up the majority of bus users overall, they are in the minority when it comes to night buses. And while we don't have data on why exactly this disparity exists, given the data we do have, it seems reasonable to conclude that feeling unsafe might have something to do with it. The good news for transport planners is that, other than increased security guard presence and lighting, none of these measures is particularly costly. And research conducted by Lukaitu Sideris in Los Angeles found that there were specific bus stops that were hotspots for gender-based crime, suggesting that costs could be kept further in check by focusing on problem areas. All each transport authority would need is its own data and the will to collect it. But that will is lacking. In the US, Lukaitu Sideris tells me, there is no federal incentive for transit authorities to collect data. They aren't legally obligated to collect it, and so they don't. She doesn't buy what she calls their excuse that they don't have the money. In India, Delhi was ranked the fourth most dangerous public transport system in the world for women in 2014. Following what came to be known as the Delhi gang rape, women are taking data collection into their own hands. This assault, which hit headlines around the world, began just after 9 p.m. on the 16th of December 2012 in South Delhi. 23-year-old physiotherapy student Jyoti Singh and her friend Avanindra Pandey had just finished watching Life of Pi at the cinema when they decided to board one of Delhi's many private buses. Their plan was to go home, but they never got there. The two friends were first severely beaten with a rusty iron rod, and then the gang of six men started to gang rape Singh. The attack, which included shoving the metal rod inside her, lasted nearly an hour, and was so brutal it perforated her colon. Eventually, having exhausted themselves, the six rapists dumped the semi-conscious friends on the roadside, 5 miles from where they had boarded the bus. 13 days later, Singh died from her injuries. The following year, three women set up a crowd-mapping platform called Safe City. Women can report the location, date, and time they were harassed, as well as what happened, so that others can view hotspots of such incidents on a map. The data collected so far is revealing. Groping is the most common type of harassment, ahead even of catcalls, and it is most likely to happen on public buses, likely because of overcrowding. Innovative solutions like this are to be welcomed, but they are not a sufficient substitute for data collected and analysed by professional researchers, and this kind of data is severely lacking in all areas of urban planning, not just transport. A 2016 article in The Guardian asking why we aren't designing cities that work for women, not just men, cautions that the limited number of urban data sets that track and trend data on gender make it hard to develop infrastructure programs that factor in women's needs. Even when we do start collecting data, there is no guarantee we will continue to do so indefinitely. In 2008, a UK-based database of research on gender and architecture was set up. By 2012, GenderSite had closed for lack of funds. And when we don't collect and crucially use sex disaggregated data in urban design, we find unintended male bias cropping up in the most surprising of places. Most women who use a gym will have experienced that moment of psyching herself up to walk into the free weights area, knowing that many of the men who dominate the space will regard her on a range from nuisance to freak. And yes, you can technically just walk in, but there's that extra mental hurdle to clear that most men simply don't face, and it takes a particular kind of self-confidence not to be bothered by it at all. Some days, you just won't feel like it. It's the same story in the outdoor gym in my local park. If it's full of men, I often give it a miss, not relishing the inevitable stares and all too clear sense that I don't belong. The inevitable reaction from some quarters to such complaints is to tell women to stop being delicate flowers, or for feminists to stop painting women as delicate flowers. And of course, some women aren't bothered by the leering and macho posturing, but women who do avoid these spaces are not being irrational, because there are plenty of accounts of hostility from men when women venture into supposedly gender-neutral shared exercise spaces. Like transit environments, then, gyms are often a classic example of a male-biased public space masquerading as equal access. The good news is that this kind of male bias can be designed out, and some of the data collection has already been done. In the mid-1990s, research by local officials in Vienna found that from the age of 10, girls' presence in parks and public playgrounds decreases significantly. But rather than simply shrugging their shoulders and deciding that girls just needed to toughen up, city officials wondered if there was something wrong with the design of parks, and so they planned some pilot projects, and they started to collect data. What they found was revealing. It turned out that single large open spaces were the problem, because these forced girls to compete with the boys for space. And girls didn't have the confidence to compete with the boys, that's social conditioning for you, so they tended to just let the boys have the space. But when they subdivided the parks into smaller areas, the female drop-off was reversed. They also addressed the park's sport facilities. Originally, these spaces were encased by wire fencing on all sides, with only a single entrance area, around which groups of boys would congregate, and the girls, unwilling to run the gauntlet, simply weren't going in. Enter stage right Vienna's very own Leslie Knope, Claudia Prinz Brandenburg, with a simple proposal: more and wider entrances. And like the grassy spaces, they also subdivided the sports courts. Formal sports like basketball were still provided for, but there was also now space for more informal activities, which girls are more likely to engage in. These were all subtle changes, but they worked. A year later, not only were there more girls in the park, the number of informal activities had increased, and now all new parks in Vienna are designed along the same lines. The city of Malmö, Sweden, discovered a similar male bias in the way they'd traditionally been planning youth urban regeneration. The usual procedure was to create spaces for skating, climbing, and painting graffiti. The trouble was, it wasn't the youth as a whole who were participating in these activities. It was almost exclusively the boys, with girls making up only 10 to 20% of those who used the city's youth-directed leisure spaces and facilities. And again, rather than shrugging their shoulders and thinking there was something wrong with the girls for not wanting to use such spaces, officials turned instead to data collection. In 2010, before they began work on their next regeneration project, converting a car park to a leisure area, city officials asked the girls what they wanted. The resulting area is well lit and, like the Viennese parks, split into a range of different sized spaces on different levels. Since then, Christian Resbo, the official from Malmö's traffic department who is involved in the project, tells me two more spaces have been developed with the intention of specifically targeting girls and younger women. The benefits of this gender-sensitive approach won't just be felt by girls. It may also be felt by the public purse. In the city of Gothenburg in Sweden, around 80 million kroner is distributed every year to sports clubs and associations. Of course, the funding is meant to benefit everyone equally, but when city officials examined the data, they found that it wasn't. The majority of funding was going to organized sports, which are dominated by boys. Grants benefited boys over girls for 36 out of 44 sports. In total, Gothenburg was spending 15 million kroner more on boys than girls' sports. This didn't just mean that girls' sports were less well-funded. Sometimes they weren't provided for at all, meaning girls had to pay to do them privately. Or, if they couldn't afford to pay, girls didn't do sports at all. Most listeners will be unsurprised by the report's conclusion that the failure to invest in girls' sport contributed to poorer mental health in girls. More unexpected, perhaps, is the claim that investing in girls' sport could reduce the health cost of fractures due to osteoporosis. Physical exercise increases young people's bone density, reducing the risk of osteoporosis later in life, with research suggesting it is especially important that young girls begin exercising before puberty. The total cost to Gothenburg of the estimated 1,000 fractures a year resulting from falls, three quarters of which are suffered by women, is around 150 million kroner. Women account for over 110 million kroner of this. As the report concludes, if an increase in the city's support for girls' sports of 15 million Swedish kroner can lead to a 14% reduction in future fractures due to osteoporosis, the investment will have paid for itself. When planners fail to account for gender, public spaces become male spaces by default. The reality is that half the global population has a female body. Half the global population has to deal on a daily basis with the sexualized menace that is visited on that body. The entire global population needs the care that, currently, is mainly carried out unpaid by women. These are not niche concerns, and if public spaces are truly to be for everyone, we have to start accounting for the lives of the other half of the world. And, as we've seen, this isn't just a matter of justice. It's also a matter of simple economics. By accounting for women's care responsibilities in urban planning, we make it easier for women to engage fully in the paid workforce. And, as we will see in the next chapter, this is a significant driver of GDP. By accounting for the sexual violence women face and introducing preventative measures, like providing enough single-sex public toilets, we save money in the long run by reducing the significant economic cost of violence against women. When we account for female socialization in the design of our open spaces and public activities, we again save money in the long run by ensuring women's long-term mental and physical health. In short, designing the female half of the world out of our public spaces is not a matter of resources. It's a matter of priorities. And, currently, whether unthinkingly or not, we just aren't prioritizing women. This is manifestly unjust and economically illiterate. Women have an equal right to public resources. We must stop excluding them by design. Part 2. The Workplace. Chapter 3. The Long Friday. By the end of the day, 24th of October 1975 came to be known by Icelandic men as the Long Friday. Supermarkets sold out of sausages, the favourite ready meal of the time. Offices were suddenly flooded with children hopped up on the sweets they had been bribed with in an effort to make them behave. Schools, nurseries, fish factories all either shut down or ran at reduced capacity. And the women? Well, the women were having a day off. 1975 had been declared by the UN as a women's year, and in Iceland, women were determined to make it count. A committee was set up with representatives from Iceland's five biggest women's organisations. After some discussion, they came up with the idea of a strike. On the 24th of October, no woman in Iceland would do a lick of work. No paid work, but also no cooking, no cleaning, no childcare. Let the men of Iceland see how they coped without the invisible work women did every day to keep the country moving. 90% of Icelandic women took part in the strike. 25,000 women gathered for a rally, the largest of more than 20 to take place throughout the country. In Reykjavik's downtown square, a staggering figure in a country of then only 220,000 people. A year later, in 1976, Iceland passed the Gender Equality Act, which outlawed sex discrimination in workplaces and schools. 5 years later, Vigdis Finnbogadottir beat three men to become the world's first democratically elected female head of state. And today, Iceland has the most gender-equal parliament in the world without a quota system. In 2017, the country topped the World Economic Forum's Global Gender Gap Index for the 8th year running. Iceland has also been named by The Economist as the best country to be a working woman. And while this is, of course, something to celebrate, there is also reason to take issue with The Economist's phrasing, because if Iceland's strike does anything, it is surely to expose the term working woman as a tautology. There is no such thing as a woman who doesn't work. There is only a woman who isn't paid for her work. Globally, 75% of unpaid work is done by women, who spend between 3 and 6 hours per day on it, compared to men's average of 30 minutes to 2 hours. This imbalance starts early. Girls as young as 5 do significantly more household chores than their brothers, and increases as they get older. Even in the country with the highest male unpaid working time, Denmark, men still spend less time on unpaid work than women in the country with the lowest female unpaid working time, Norway. Whenever I raise the issue of the unpaid work imbalance between men and women, I am invariably faced with the comment, "But surely it's getting better. Surely men are gradually doing more of their share. And at an individual level, sure, there are men who are doing more. But at a population level? Well, no, not really, because it turns out that the proportion of unpaid work men do is remarkably sticky. An Australian study found that even in wealthier couples who pay for domestic help, the remaining unpaid work is still distributed at the same male-to-female ratio, with women still doing the majority of what's left. And as women have increasingly joined the paid labour force, men have not matched this shift with a comparative increase in their unpaid work. Women have simply increased their total work time, with numerous studies over the past 20 years finding that women do the majority of unpaid work, irrespective of the proportion of household income they bring in. Even when men do increase their unpaid work, it isn't by doing the routine housework that forms the majority of the workload, instead creaming off the more enjoyable activities like childcare. On average, 61% of housework is undertaken by women. In India, for example, 5 out of women's 6 daily hours of unpaid labour are spent on housework, compared to men's 13 minutes. It's also rare for men to take on the more personal, messy, emotionally draining aspects of elder care work. In the UK, up to 70% of all unpaid dementia carers are women, and female carers are more likely to help with bathing, dressing, using the toilet, and managing incontinence. Women are more than twice as likely as men to be providing intensive on-duty care for someone 24 hours a day and to have been caring for someone with dementia for more than 5 years. Female carers also tend to receive less support than male carers, so they end up feeling more isolated and being more likely to suffer from depression, in itself a risk factor for dementia. Men, meanwhile, have carried on engaging in leisure pursuits, watching TV, playing sports, playing computer games. US men managed to find over an hour more spare time per day to rest than their female counterparts, while in the UK, the Office for National Statistics found that men enjoy 5 hours more leisure time per week than women. And an Australian study found that what little leisure time women do have is more fractured and combined with other tasks than men's. The upshot is that around the world, with very few exceptions, women work longer hours than men. Sex disaggregated data is not available for all countries, but for those where the data exists, the trend is clear. In Korea, women work for 34 minutes longer than men per day. In Portugal, it's 90 minutes. In China, it's 44 minutes. And in South Africa, it's 48 minutes. The size of the gap varies from country to country. The World Bank estimates that in Uganda, women work an average of 15 hours every day to men's average of 9 hours, but the existence of a gap remains more or less constant. A 2010 US study on the imbalance between the amount of unpaid work done by male and female scientists found that female scientists do 54% of the cooking, cleaning, and laundry in their households, adding more than 10 hours to their nearly 60-hour work week, while men's contribution, 28%, adds only half that time. The women in their dataset also did 54% of parenting labour in their households, while male scientists did 36%. In India, 66% of women's work time is spent on unpaid labour, while only 12% of men's work is unpaid. In Italy, 61% of women's work is unpaid, compared to 23% of men's. In France, 57% of their work is unpaid, compared to 38% of men's. All this extra work is affecting women's health. We have long known that women, in particular women under 55, have worse outcomes than men following heart surgery. But it wasn't until a Canadian study came out in 2016 that researchers were able to isolate women's care burden as one of the factors behind this discrepancy. We have noticed that women who have bypass surgery tend to go right back into their caregiver roles, while men were more likely to have someone to look after them, explained lead researcher Colleen Norris. This observation may go some way to explaining why a Finnish study found that single women recovered better from heart attacks than married women, particularly when put alongside a University of Michigan study which found that husbands create an extra 7 hours of housework a week for women. An Australian study similarly found that housework time is most equal by gender for single men and women. When women start to cohabit, their housework time goes up, while men's goes down, regardless of their employment status. The Economist isn't alone in forgetting about women's unpaid workload in their discussions of work. When business magazines like Inc. publish think pieces telling us that science tells us you shouldn't work more than 40 hours a week, or when The Guardian informs us that your job could be killing you if you work for more than 39 hours per week, they aren't talking to women, because for women, there is no if. Women do work well over this amount, regularly, and it is killing them. It starts with stress. In 2017, the UK's Health and Safety Executive, HSE, released a report on stress in the workplace, which revealed that, in every age range, women had higher rates of work-related stress, anxiety, and depression than men. Overall, women were 53% more stressed than men, but the difference was particularly dramatic in the age range 35 to 44. For men, the rate was 1,270 cases per 100,000 workers. For women, it was nearly double that, at 2,250 cases per 100,000 workers. The HSE concluded that this disparity was a result of the sectors women work in. Stress is more prevalent in public service industries, such as education, health, and social care, as well as cultural differences in attitudes and beliefs between males and females around the subject of stress. These may well be part of the reason, but the HSE's analysis is sporting a pretty dramatic gender data gap. Since 1930, the International Labour Organization, ILO, has stipulated that no one should exceed 48 hours a week at work, by which they meant paid work. Beyond this number of hours, workers start incurring health costs. But there is a growing consensus that things may be a little bit more complicated than that. A 2011 analysis of data collected on British civil servants between 1997 and 2004 found that working more than 55 hours per week significantly increased women's risk of developing depression and anxiety, but did not have a statistically significant impact on men. Even working 41 to 55 hours seemed to increase the probability of mental health problems in women. This was in line with a 1999 Canadian study and a 2017 analysis of 6 years of data from the Household Income Labour Dynamics of Australia survey, both of which found that women had to work far fewer paid hours than men before their mental health started to deteriorate. But it's not only about mental health. Swedish studies have found that moderate overtime work increases women's hospitalisation and mortality rate, but has a protective effect for men. A 2016 US paper on the impact of long work hours over a 32-year period found a similar gender disparity. Working moderately long hours, 41 to 50 hours per week, was associated with less risk of contracting heart disease, chronic lung disease, or depression in men. By contrast, such hours for female workers led to consistent and alarming increases in life-threatening diseases, including heart disease and cancer. Women's risk of developing these diseases started to rise when they worked more than 40 hours per week. If they worked for an average of 60 hours per week for over 30 years, their risk of developing one of these diseases tripled. So what's going on? Is this all proof that women are in fact the weaker sex? Not exactly. In fact, the Australian study found that although the average man could work substantially longer hours than the average woman before his mental health was negatively impacted, there was one group of workers for whom the gender gap was much narrower. These workers are called the unencumbered, that is, workers with little to no care responsibilities. For the unencumbered, both men's and women's work hour thresholds were much closer to the 48 hours stipulated by the ILO. The problem is, women aren't unencumbered. It's just that the work they do is invisible. When Ryan Gosling thanked his partner Eva Mendes at the 2017 Golden Globes for her unpaid work, acknowledging that without it he would not be on stage accepting an award, he marked himself out as a rare man. Far more usual is the impressively unperceptive man Guardian columnist Hadley Freeman wrote about in 2018. "I have kids and I work full time," one boss crossly told a friend of mine who asked to have Fridays off. "Yes, and your wife quit her job to look after the kids," my friend couldn't quite bring herself to reply. This man simply couldn't see, or perhaps didn't want to see, all the unpaid work that gets done around him. The unpaid work that enables him to have kids and easily work full-time in paid employment. It doesn't occur to him that the reason he doesn't need Fridays off is not that he's better than his female co-worker, but rather that, unlike him, she doesn't have a full-time wife at home. Of course, most male bosses in heterosexual relationships won't have a full-time wife at home, because most women can't afford to quit work entirely. Instead, women accommodate their care responsibilities by going part-time. In the UK, 42% of women compared to 11% of men work part-time, and women make up 75% of part-time workers. And part-time work is paid less per hour than full-time work, in part because it's rare that a high-level post is offered as a job share or with flexible working hours. Women end up working in jobs below their skill level that offer them the flexibility they need, but not the pay they deserve. In Scotland in 2016, the average hourly gender wage gap was 15%, but this average hid the substantial disparity between full-time and part-time work. For those in full-time work, the hourly gap went down to 11%, but the hourly pay gap between men working full-time and women working part-time was 32%. In 2017, median hourly pay for full-time employees across the UK was £14 per hour, compared with £9.12 for part-time employees. Some call women's segregation into low-paid work a choice, but it's a funny kind of choice when there is no realistic option other than the children not being cared for and the housework not getting done. In any case, 50 years' worth of US census data has proven that when women join an industry in high numbers, that industry attracts lower pay and loses prestige, suggesting that low-paid work chooses women rather than the other way round. This choice that isn't a choice is making women poor. A recent Organisation for the Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, study found that the gender pay gap in hourly wages is substantially higher in countries where women spend a large amount of time on unpaid care compared to men. In the UK, women make up 61% of those earning below the living wage, and the Institute for Fiscal Studies has found that the gender pay gap widens over the 12 years after a child is born to 33%, as women's careers and wages stagnate. The US pay gap between mothers and married fathers is three times higher than the pay gap between men and women without children. Over time, these pay gaps add up. In Germany, a woman who has given birth to one child can expect to earn up to $285,000 less by the time she's 45 than a woman who has worked full-time without interruption. Data from France, Germany, Sweden, and Turkey shows that even after accounting for social transfers that some countries employ to recognise the contribution women make through their unpaid care work, women earn between 31% and 75% less than men over their lifetimes. This all leaves women facing extreme poverty in their old age, in part because they simply can't afford to save for it. But it's also because when governments are designing pension schemes, they aren't accounting for women's lower lifetime earnings. This isn't exactly a data gap because the data does mostly exist, but collecting the data is useless unless governments use it. And they don't. Largely on the advice of international financial institutions such as the World Bank, the last two decades have seen an increasing global shift from social insurance to, often privately managed, individual capital account schemes. The payments a pensioner receives are directly based on their past contributions and the number of years during which the person is expected to collect benefits. This means women are penalised for the following: having to take time out for unpaid care work, early retirement, still a legal requirement in certain countries and professions, and for living longer. Other policies simply benefit men more than women. These include Australia's recent tax concessions for pension funds, men are likely to have a higher pension pot, and the UK's recent shift to auto-enrolment. As with many pensions around the world, this policy makes the standard error of forgetting to compensate women for the time they have to take out of the paid labour force to attend to their unpaid care load. As a result, women miss out on vital contributions to their pension. More unforgivable is the British system's failure to account for the fact that women are more likely to have several part-time jobs in order to combine their paid and unpaid workloads. In order to qualify for the auto-enrolment pension, a worker must earn at least £10,000 a year. But while many women do earn past this threshold, they earn it from multiple employers, and combined earnings are not counted towards the threshold. This means that 32%, or 2.7 million employed women, will not earn enough to benefit from auto-enrolment, compared to 14% of employed men. A counterpoint is provided by Brazil, Bolivia, and Botswana, which have achieved close to universal pension coverage and smaller gender gaps thanks to the introduction of widely available non-contributory pensions. Women in Bolivia are credited with 1 year of pension contributions per child, up to a maximum of 3 children. As a side benefit, and a more long-term solution to the problem of feminised poverty, pension credits for the main carer have also been found to encourage men to take on more of the unpaid care load, which raises the question: is women's unpaid work undervalued because we don't see it, or is it invisible because we don't value it? Alongside addressing male bias in pensions, governments must address feminised poverty in old age by introducing policies that enable women to stay in paid work. That starts, but certainly doesn't end, with properly paid maternity leave. EU countries with comprehensive support for working parents have the highest rates of female employment. Numerous studies worldwide have shown that maternity leave has a positive impact on women's participation in the paid labour market. This impact is seen not only in the raw numbers of women employed, but also in the number of hours they work and the income they earn. It has been shown to be particularly beneficial for low-income women. There is a caveat, however. Not all maternity leave policies are made equal. The length of time and the amount of money on offer matter. If women aren't given enough time off, there is a risk they will leave the paid labour force entirely or transition to part-time work. When Google noticed that they were losing women who had just given birth at twice the rate of other employees, they increased their maternity leave from 3 months at partial pay to 5 months at full pay. The attrition rate dropped 50%. With the exception of the US, all industrialised countries guarantee workers paid maternity leave, but most countries aren't hitting the sweet spot either in pay or the length of leave allowed, and they certainly aren't hitting them both together. A recent Australian analysis found that the optimum length of paid maternity leave for ensuring women's continued participation in paid labour was between 7 months to a year, and there is no country in the world that offers properly paid leave for that length of time. 12 countries in the OECD offer full replacement wages, but none of these countries offers more than 20 weeks, with the average being 15 weeks. Portugal, for instance, one of the countries that offers 100% replacement wages, offers only 6 weeks of leave. Australia, by contrast, offers 18 weeks of maternity leave, but at 42% of earnings. Ireland offers 26 weeks, but at only 34% of earnings. For women in these countries, the full length of time they're technically allowed to take off can be, as a result, academic. British politicians like to boast, particularly in the run-up to the EU referendum, that the UK offers a more generous maternity leave than the 14 weeks mandated by the EU's 1992 Pregnant Workers Directive. This is technically true, but it doesn't mean that women in the UK get a good deal in comparison to their European counterparts. The average length of paid maternity leave across the EU is 22 weeks. This figure hides substantial regional variation in both pay and length. Croatia offers 30 weeks at full pay, compared to the UK's offering of 39 weeks at an average of 30% pay. In fact, a 2017 analysis placed the UK 22nd out of 24 European countries on the length of decently paid maternity leave it offered its female workforce, 1.4 months. And now that Britain is leaving the EU, the country is likely to fall even further below its European neighbours. Since 2008, the EU has been trying to extend its maternity leave ruling to 20 weeks on full pay. This proposal was stuck in stalemate for years and finally abandoned in 2015, thanks in no small part to the UK and its business lobby, which campaigned strenuously against it. Without the UK, the women of the EU will be free to benefit from this more progressive leave allowance. Meanwhile, Martin Callanan, now a Brexit minister, made a speech to the European Parliament in 2012 in which he included the Pregnant Workers Directive in his list of the barriers to actually employing people, which we could scrap. For some women in Britain, no maternity leave at all is already a reality because the Pregnant Workers Directive doesn't cover female politicians. Women in the National Parliament have access to maternity leave, but there is no provision for them to vote without turning up in person. Technically, women on maternity leave can make use of a system called pairing, where one MP is matched with an MP who would vote in the opposite direction, and neither vote. However, in July 2018, we saw just how inadequate this solution is, when the Conservative MP Brandon Lewis, who was paired with the Lib Dem MP Jo Swinson, mysteriously forgot he was paired when it came to two crucial Brexit votes that the government won by an extremely narrow margin. But bad as this is, it's even worse in local government. Under Section 85 of the Local Government Act 1972, if a councillor does not attend council for 6 months, they lose their position unless the authority has approved their absence. You might hope that an approved absence would include maternity leave, but a report commissioned by women's charity the Fawcett Society found that only 12 councils, 4%, in England have a formal maternity leave policy, and although some have informal arrangements, three-quarters offer nothing at all. And so, as a result of policies which forget that half the population can, and often do, give birth, women lose their jobs. In 2015, Councillor Charlene McLean had to stay in hospital for months after she gave birth prematurely. Despite having remained in contact with the council, and having been informed she had normal workers' rights, when she returned to work, she was told she would have to stand for re-election because she had been off for 6 months. Even after what happened to McLean, Newham Council did not change its rules to account for women's bodily realities, instead simply opting to ensure that all expectant mothers received the right information about their lack of rights. The following year, Bridget Jones, a Birmingham City Councillor, was told that she would have to step down from her role as Cabinet Member for Children's Services if she became pregnant. Things are worse for women in the US, which is one of only four countries in the world that doesn't guarantee at least some paid maternity leave. The Family and Medical Leave Act guarantees 12 weeks of unpaid leave, but amongst other restrictions, you are eligible only if you have worked for a business with at least 50 other employees for the past 12 months. As a result, even unpaid leave is only available to 60% of the workforce. There is nothing to prevent the remaining 40% of US women being fired. And of course, the number of women who can afford to take unpaid leave is lower. One in four American mothers return to work within 2 weeks of giving birth. For some US women, the gaps are filled in at a state or industry level. In January 2016, President Barack Obama gave federal workers 6 weeks of paid care leave, while four states, California, Rhode Island, New York, and New Jersey, along with Washington, D.C., now offer paid family leave, funded through employee social insurance. Some women are lucky enough to work at companies that offer maternity leave. But even with these gaps plugged, around 85% of US women have no form of paid leave. There have been various failed attempts to address this through legislation, a recent one being Trump's proposal in the 2018 federal budget to pay new mothers 6 weeks of unemployment benefit. This did not pass, but even if it had, the length allowed and the amount paid would not be sufficient to impact on women's participation in the paid labour force. And this is something that the US badly needs, as, in contrast to other industrialised nations, US women's paid labour force participation is actually decreasing, with a 2013 study finding that the lack of family-friendly policies accounts for nearly a third of the discrepancy. And so the US government continues to attempt to find ways to fix this apparently intractable problem. The latest wheeze, however, provides little more than another example of how gender-blind policy can unwittingly discriminate against women. As I write in 2018, Republicans in Congress are getting excited about the idea of letting people collect Social Security benefits early to pay for maternity leave, and then delaying their retirement payments to offset the costs. It's easy to see why the idea is attractive. It comes without a cost, at least to the government. But it is far from cost-free to women. The gender pay gap and the time women take off to care for children already results in lower Social Security benefits for women, a problem this policy will exacerbate. And given women live longer and spend more of their later years in ill health, they arguably need more money for retirement, not less. As a result, The main impact of this policy would be to compound the problem of feminized old age poverty. US universities provide another example of how gender-blind leave policies can end up discriminating against women. US academics in the tenure track system have 7 years to receive tenure after getting their first academic job, or they're fired. This system is biased against women, especially women who want to have children, in part because the years between completing a PhD and receiving tenure, between 30 and 40, coincide with the years these women are most likely to try for a baby. The result? Married mothers with young children are 35% less likely than married fathers of young children to get tenure-track jobs, and among tenured faculty, 70% of men are married with children compared to 44% of women. Universities have done little to address this, and even those that have tried have often done so in gender-blind ways that may end up exacerbating the problem they were trying to solve. In the 1990s and early 2000s, a number of US universities adopted what was intended as a family-friendly policy. Parents would receive an extra year per child to earn tenure. But it isn't gender-neutral parents who need this extra year. It is specifically mothers. As the University of Michigan's Allison Davis Blake dryly noted in the New York Times, giving birth is not a gender-neutral event. While women may be, variously, throwing up, going to the toilet every 5 minutes, changing nappies, or plugged into their breast pump during this extra year,